Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
You know, the book was originally titled Hatred, but my editor wouldn't stand for that. And I think Property is the better title. But there's two scenes in the book that are quite graphic, and both of them people seem to get stuck there, and in some ways I wish I hadn't done that. But, you know, there it is. That's how it starts.
I'm sorry. Please continue.
No, that's okay. What were you going to say?
I was just going to try to take a guess at the other scene that people get stuck on.
You know what it is. It's the breastfeeding.
Yep.
In fact, one reviewer, Alan Schuth, who's a friend of mine, said it was the most shocking scene in American literature.
Wow.
Which was really, you know, I was just delighted.
Wow. In the interest of time, I'm not going to read that second scene, but we should have a brief window between after Miss Martin exits and when Dr. Smith arrives. If we have time, I'll read that second scene so you all will know what we're talking about. I will just say, reading it now, this book was published in 2003, correct, Miss Martin?
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, it's almost 10 years old.
Okay. Context. Reading this book now, with what happened with Jerry Sandusky and it being widely reported and hinted at that so many of his victims were young black male children, and what happened at the Los Angeles school where they ended up firing the entire staff, where you got a white teacher.
That's right. I hadn't thought about that. Yeah.
Man. Woo. This is what racism, white supremacy produces, has, as you said, sex at the core of this, and particularly property. This is not a human being. This is property. I can do whatever I want. Invariably, that is going to play out in some form of sexual domination. And I think that pops up.
Yeah, I know.
Kindred, it's
Why
right at the...
It?
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Why is that?
Well, sure of you. You wrote...
I mean, there's something about having... When somebody is completely subjected to you, I mean, you may have employees, you know, and children. I just, when I think about, you know, what that impulse is, why, because I own somebody, do I have to exploit them to the very limit of endurance? I mean, what I found out about and what I think about the system of slavery in the South, slavery is not new, and it was all over the world, and it's not only black people that have been slaves, but that particular system was so perversely designed. It was as if they sat down and tried to think about the most perverse thing we could do to humiliate and to control a large captive population, which is what they had. You know, and the plantations were sometimes, the owners and the white people were outnumbered 100-1. So this was a really challenge to have constant control, and they came up with these various little twists and systems to make everything as perverse as possible. One of them was that, I'll say this because you're thinking of reading the breastfeeding scene. White women didn't breastfeed their babies; their slaves breastfed the babies. So when Edgar Degas came to New Orleans, he said you often would see sitting on a park bench a woman with her own baby on one breast and her owner's baby on the other. And I was thinking about that woman's situation as a mother, which I am. on one breast she has her own child who she doesn't own herself, who she can't hold on to, who may be sold. And on her other breast, she has a child who will own her.
Wow.
So that takes all the maternal impulse that you might, I mean, everything that might allow you to have a normal maternal feeling towards a baby that you're nursing has been twisted so that you can't have it.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, March 17th, 2017. So I have been told. I hope folks are remaining safe. I think this is a quote-unquote holiday that people generally use as an excuse to do a lot of binge alcohol consumption. So I hope folks are staying safe, especially since it fell on a Friday. Then, you know, we got to have an extra round of alcoholic beverages to act nutty. At any rate, this is our eighth book study session on The Delectable Negro, Vincent Woodard's The Delectable Negro, Human Consumption and Homoeroticism in U.S. Slave Culture. Has been a fascinating read. Some portions we have agreed with, some portions we have not. Whatever the case, we are very close to the conclusion of the book. Last week we were on chapter 5, Eating Nat Turner. We were almost at the conclusion, so we're picking up. Right. Matter of fact, I can give you the exact page number. We're picking up on page 202 on the book that I have, and we're about halfway down the page, the paragraph that begins by simplifying the debate into two types. That's what we're picking up at for this week's section. The audio snippets you heard at the beginning of the program, that was Valerie Martin, suspected racist. She was on the program way back in 2012. I mentioned this book, I think, 2 weeks ago. I stated her name incorrectly then. I think I said Valerie Jackson. Her name is Valerie Martin, and her novel is Property, and it opens with the scene of a white racist slave master raping young black children on the plantation. When I say young, I mean like 10 and younger. And then there's a scene later in the book where a black female, she had been nursing her child, and this white racist slave master comes and begins sucking on her breast. And the scene ends where the white woman says that this black female is right to turn away, because if the enslaved black female dared to look at her, she would have smacked her in the face. But this is all in the book, and we discussed it with Miss Martin some years ago. Consumption. With that, we'll go ahead and get started. Context of white supremacy. Again, this is Vincent Woodard's The Delectable Negro, audio segment number one.
By simplifying the debate into two types: the black man who was virile and could not be consumed, and the black man who was effeminate, tender-fleshed, and could be consumed, we have missed out on a deeper understanding of the ways homoeroticism has permeated black liberation discourse. When I first cited Harding's comments on cannibalism at the beginning of this chapter, I told only part of the story, the part of the story that concerned white appetites for consumption. However, it was not as simple as I initially suggested, that only white people wanted to consume, ingest, and be filled with black male essence. Black men wanted this too, however, for entirely different and sacred reasons. Harding upbraids and severely criticizes Styron for cannibalizing Turner. In the same breath, Harding speaks of Turner's message, his virile word, and his masculinity as something that black men such as himself can eat, Turner's body in words going down as sweet as honey. He likens Turner to Ezekiel from the Bible, Ezekiel who was forced to eat the scroll with the Lord's word to fill his stomach with the terrible oracles of God. In Harding's articulation, fierce religious conviction, power, and liberating truth tenderize black male flesh into a nourishing source ingested and integrated into the black spiritual collective. In her essay, Where, by the way, is this train going? A case for reframing black cultural studies, May G. Henderson comments upon the edible, flesh-eating dynamic between black sons like Harding and their symbolic fathers, W.E.B. Du Bois, John Henry Clark, and George Washington Williams. Harding, she writes, constructs the origins of black studies in a narrative which fashions an Oedipal tale of black sons, especially with westernized training, who seek to devour their fathers. Black studies served as an intellectual counterpart to black power activism and community-based organizing. What black feminists and so-called homophile figures such as Baldwin were painfully aware of was how this dynamic of the chosen black son excluded women and homosexual men as representative voices of black experience. As Henderson points out, black men sanctioned, institutionalized, even the homoerotic triad among black father, son, and Western white male tradition. In his Beyond Chaos, Black History and the Search for the New Land, the document to which Henderson's comments refer, Harding makes reference to the character of Trueblood from Ralph Ellison's novel Invisible Man. She romanticizes Trueblood's raping of his daughter, the black female sexual orifice bonding Trueblood and the white man, Mr. Norton, in an erotic tryst. Mr. Norton realized that Trueblood had struggled with some of the same demons which he had sought to escape. It was then that Norton exclaimed in wonder, "You have looked upon the chaos and are not destroyed." The black man and white man feel unified in their fear, objectification, and use of the black female's body, her vagina. Trueblood projects his own feelings of emasculation, sexual violation, and economic disempowerment onto the black female body. The more central problem here, though, is black male interiority, the black male orifice. The black female body is and always has served as a convenient, all too familiar tabula rasa for working out confusions, aggressions, instabilities, and a host of other masculine anxieties. If we replace the female body with that of the male, the essay's reference to chaos takes on new meaning. Chaos as the black male anus, chaos as the black male mouth, chaos as the metaphysical, the quantum conundrum of a black male orifice that devours and consumes as easily as it might constitute and reify masculinity. In the section that follows this discussion, Harding talks of the same blackness that he associates with Trueblood and the black fathers as something that he, in the darkness, touches and gropes with erotic longing. As we handle our blackness, we are tempted to fondle it, to worship it, to lie down in its beauty and sleep a long black sleep of rapping and joy. The sentence that follows this one clarifies its reference to the phallic might of black revolutionaries, such as Brother Fanon and our fathers. Under the guise of revolution, of racial uplift and racial unity, Harding observations reveal a powerfully charged domain of black male experience wherein the consumption of and groping of the phallus, sons eating fathers and fathers eating sons, and a general erotic sharing among black men is the norm. It is a painful mythic and social reality that Harding imagines, in which hurt is necessary, for it grows at once out of the nature of the struggle and out of the natural tendency of the sons, especially with westernized training, to seek to devour their fathers. Harding writes against a legacy of consuming blacks, tasting them, and making them into delectable objects of white phallic authority. For that is the ultimate tragedy and failure of paternal figures such as George Washington Williams, Booker T. Washington, and even Carter G. Woodson, that they function as delectable Negroes who have so deeply internalized the palate of the white fathers that they cannot help but feed their male progeny in body, soul, and essence to the insatiable hunger of white America. For example, Williams, the author of the first full-length historical treatment of black people in the Americas, History of the Negro Race in America, 1619 through 1880, advocated black assimilation into the body politic. The colored people had always displayed a matchless patriotism and an incomparable heroism in the cause of Americans. Williams glorified the white male body of persons such as Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, and Abraham Lincoln. He also glorified the tenets and the law of American democracy. Contrary to Harding's glorification of the black male body, and in particular the phallus, Williams' primary romantic affection is towards the white male, for whom the state is an extension of his authority, and a power to either annihilate or consume. As a devouring black father who has an appetite spurred by his loyalty to the drives and palates of white fathers, Williams is a figure that the black son must devour if the race is to survive. In addition to casting black history and collectivity in a traditional gender framework that threatens to undermine the intervention he is attempting to make, what also occurs within Harding's tableau of eat or be eaten is that so much complexity and differing meanings of appetite and consumption get obscured. The general sexual violation of black men during slavery does not figure into Harding's analogy. According to Harding, this history and the figure of the sexually violated black man literally represents the threat of black male virility being devoured by inverted sexuality. The ultimate psychic and social threat of the effeminate or rape black is not only that he can take in sex, hunger for and desire it in his interior, but also that he has, in addition to this hunger, the capacity to castrate, bite, chew, and disappear into a teeming chaos, the continuity and vital essence of the race. Harding's glorification and eroticization of the black male phallus demonstrates how homoeroticism was intrinsic to black cultural formation in his formulations. Whereas the invert, who resonates too closely with the historical notions of black men as unclean, as unchristian, as licentious, effeminate, unbounded, and insane, is the figure that has been most difficult to incorporate into the body politic. In There Is a River, The Black Struggle for Freedom in America, Harding refers to Malcolm X as the shining black prince of the Northern movement. King was also referred to in this way by black men. Black people worshiped both men, saw them as beauty itself, and both radiated a seductive air of rest and long-awaited joyfulness. Harding romanticizes the seductive virility of blackness and its hidden phallic implications. So too does he romanticize female rape, incest, and white male fascination with women raped on the plantation. This dynamic calls to mind the contradictory words and actions of Eldridge Cleaver. On the one hand, Cleaver could lambast Baldwin as a virile Negro homosexual, a race traitor, and so forth, and on the other hand, show up at a party with UEP Newton, run into Baldwin at the party, and engage Baldwin in a long, passionate French kiss. Newton recalls, in 1967, Cleaver was invited to a special dinner for James Baldwin, who had just returned from Turkey, and he in turn invited me. When we arrived, Cleaver and Baldwin walked into each other, and the giant 6'3" Cleaver bent down and engaged in a long, passionate French kiss with the tiny, barely 5 feet Baldwin. Another example from the civil rights era is King, who engaged in frequent sexual escapades with white and black women in scenarios that involved him and other black men having sex in the same room and switching female partners and doing who knows what else. King clearly loved sex and exhibited an uninhibited aspect of his sexual nature. Yet King folded under pressure from within the movement to publicly distance himself from Bayard Rustin, the openly homosexual strategist and organizer of the March on Washington, and to not allow Rustin to speak at the March on Washington. All of which brings me to the question, what are we really talking about when we talk about homoeroticism in the civil rights and black power eras, and, in particular, in the context of slavery? How are we to make sense of Harding's idea of the sacred consumption of the black fathers alongside the glorification of black female rape and the demonization and misrecognition of homoeroticism during Harding's time and in the context of slavery? What Harding understood as sacred consumption was partially that, but it was also part of something larger, more complicated and disturbing. Douglass, for example, was painfully aware of those aspects of the slave experience that were causing us to eat our own flesh. In his slave narrative, Douglass referred to the legacy of violence and terror that had caused many slaves to remain frozen in terror and apathetic to their bonded status. He referred to the constant haunting presence of grim death, a catch-all term for the range of horrid deaths that resulted from desperation, nihilism, and soul murder. Douglass understood self-consumption as a process of turning in upon the self, a natural response to the physical and spiritual starvation endemic to the culture of slavery. Fixated on the idea of the valiant, heroic black man who is impervious to consumption, except consumption in a sacred way, we have remained transfixed by those final determining words. You have seen how a man was made a slave. You shall see how a man, a slave, was made a man. Especially in the 1960s, most black people accepted the battle as the index of black masculinity largely without question. Yet what I have been attempting to elucidate throughout this chapter are more subtle levels of warfare and resistance that defy simplistic dyads. Consumed, not consumed. Effeminate, masculine. Race man, not race man. As mightily as black people have struggled to fend off the reality of Nat Turner's consumption, the fact is that he was most likely literally consumed. And in the meantime, our analytic, historical, psychic, and political tools have been insufficient to the task of analyzing how his consumption was possible, how it might in fact be ongoing, and how we, in the present moment, are implicated in the legacy of Turner's consumption. Chapter 6, The Hungry Nigger. At the end of the 20th century, black gay men began to bravely articulate and embody a suppressed history and politics of the black male orifice. For example, Essex Hemphill's brazen anal erotic manifesto, Loyalty, marked a historic moment in black sexual politics and cultural recovery. Tracking an epistemology of the anus rooted in black Christian ideologies and faith practices stemming back to slavery, Hemphill writes, "For my so-called sins against nature and the race, I gain the burdensome knowledge of carnal secrets. A knowledge disquieting and liberating inhabits my soul. It often comforts me, or at times is miserably intoxicating with requisite hangovers and regrets. At other moments, it is a sacred communion, causing me to moan and tremble and cuss as the Holy Ghost fucks me. It is a knowledge of fire and beauty that I will carry beyond the grave. When I sit in God's final judgment, I will wager this knowledge against my entrance into the Holy Kingdom." Hemphill writes against the normative logics of nature and race, founding his complaint within the taboo, interior regions of the male anus. The anus functions here as a vehicle of erotic coupling, as a site of knowledge and apprehension, as a means of existential inquiry, and as a central ground of racial formation. Religiosity and saving of oneself and community figure centrally in black epistemology and experience. Through the sacred idea of and sacred relationship to his anus, Hemphill builds upon a legacy of black people using their bodies and body parts and slavery to reconfigure the precincts of the sacred and humane. For example, as I have noted, Sojourner Truth, at strategic moments in her oratory career, referred to her breasts and her womb in public speeches. This referencing of her body parts had a dual effect. First, it allowed her to make claims to the spiritual and maternal authority of women from the Bible. And second, It facilitated her challenge to the stereotype of the masculinized black woman. In The Confessions of Nat Turner, recorded by Thomas R. Gray, Nat Turner too experiences the Holy Ghost as a mediating and corporealized experience. "And from the first steps of righteousness until the last, I was made perfect. The Holy Ghost was with me." Hemphill experiences the Holy Ghost as anal penetration and a resultant sacred bloodshed, and Turner also experiences the Holy Ghost as blood physically manifested in the natural world. "I discovered drops of blood on the corn as though it were dew from heaven, and now the Holy Ghost had revealed itself to me and made plain the miracles it had shown me." Though Hemphill was not a slave, feelings of captivity and the erasure of his humanity motivate him to articulate a praxis of anal spiritual liberation that has cleared and antecedents in the itinerant and radical black Christian systems that Turner and Truth embody. In revising these traditions to include the black male anus, Hemphill encourages a rethinking of deity, corporeality, and black cultural formation in the past and the present. With another eye toward racial revisioning, Ron Simmons, in the same decade as Hemphill, challenged the sexual hypocrisy of the black arts movement, focusing in particular on Amiri Baraka's homophobia and formulation of a negative anal sexual politics. "Perhaps," writes Simmons, "it is the homosexual desires Baraka had as an adolescent and young adult that motivate his homophobia." Simmons traces Baraka's malice and violent disposition toward the faggot to the author's vexed experiences with anal sex. Baraka admits these experiences to a hooker named Peaches after failed attempts to achieve erection. "I'm sorry. I'm fucked up. My mind is screwed. I don't know why. I can't think. I'm sick. I've been fucked in the ass." The penis and the anus represent, for Baraka, two opposing nodes of black experience. In his poetry, political writings, and plays, Baraka associates the phallus with male-female coupling, racial solidarity, and black male heroicism. The anus and anal copulation, on the other hand, represent the erosion of black male prowess and sexual vigor, and the breakdown of racial solidarity. Simmons also traces these negative implications of the anus and of black gay identity to the ideologies and political praxis of another Afrocentric thinker and leaders, such as Haki Madhubuti, Louis Farrakhan, Ben Johakan, and Molefe Asante. Ultimately, Simmons writes to revise historical misrepresentations and to reclaim the anus as a site of liberation of black people. Other black gay scholars and artists have staked out claims similar to those of Simmons and Hemphill, arguing for a broad understanding of the anus and the black male oral cavity as viable sites of eroticism and black cultural formation. Gary Fisher, for example, recovers the black male oral cavity as a complicated site of slave history, historically based trauma, sexual play, and racial formation. Robert Reed Farr also sketches a genealogy of civil American race talk, extending back to the debauchery of the slave master who has left a raw milk smell of cum on the breath of both the antebellum nigger and the contemporary black. Charles I. Nero correlates anal sexual activity between two black men on a plantation in the 18th century to the need to rethink, in the past and the present, our models of the black family and homosexuality as alien to black culture. Black gay men, writing at the end of the 20th century, demonstrated the culturally challenging and historically problematic nature of the eroticized black male orifice. through their personal sexual politics and appeals to a broader racial political platform. They argued for the need to rethink the genealogy of the black male orifice, to re-examine its political import, to decouple the orifice from black gay bodies and sex practices, and to begin, in the most creative ways possible, to locate black self-fashioning and cultural formation within the eroticized male interior. As I have argued throughout the book, the black male interior has constituted a highly under-theorized yet impacting region of black male experience. By grounding this notion of the interior in eroticized regions of the male body, black gays have begun collectively to blueprint a way for us to finally and fully begin to inhabit, and theorize this idea of the black male interior. Hemphill's luscious taking of the Holy Ghost into his anus and Fisher's correlating of oral sexual hunger with slave ancestry and Hegel's philosophy of the master-slave dialectic each serve as examples of a rich interior terrain existing just beyond the erogenous threshold. Each artist depicts the black male interior as an erogenous and culturally relevant structure rooted in the body's emotional and spiritual needs. What I want to hone in on and make more explicit in this chapter is the historical tie between the black male orifice and a largely unspoken politics of interiority. The eroticized anal and oral orifices in and of themselves have not constituted a problem for black cultural formation. In fact, black people have, to useful ends, imagine these regions of the male body as surface structures, as demarcating and indecipherable zones of experience. This mode of imagining has facilitated, for example, black men and women of the 1960s equating same-sex practices with seeds of a racial death wish implanted during slavery. For example, W.E.B. Du Bois construed Augustus Dill, the black man arrested for having tear room sex in the 1920s, as a threat to black uplift and the dismantling of the historically laden color line. In firing Dill, a devoted cultural worker, for his arrest and expressing disdain toward tear room sex, Du Bois reinforced ideas of the homoerotic anus and mouth as dangerous corporeal regions that were antithetical to black experience. From these 20th century examples, we get a sense of the anus and oral cavity depicted in racial uplift contexts as racial grave sites and terrains of experience existing beyond the boundaries of blackness. Such modes of thinking reinforce the notion of the black male erotic interior as empty, as unspeakable and unknowable, as uninhabitable and fundamentally antithetical to black experience. Bringing together the slave past with the present, I use Toni Morrison's Beloved to initiate a discussion of black male interiority in slave history and within the collective black memory of slavery. Focusing on what many have referred to as the male rape scene in the novel, I point out some of the limitations and inaccuracies of the term rape. Rape names acts of sexual violation in the novel, but obscures realities of black male sex and sexual appetite. Furthermore, rape, as most conceive of it, gives no indications of the rich interior and emotional life that precedes and follows the sexually violating act. These surface-level and more contemporary readings have also involved equating male rape and eroticism during slavery with contemporary black gay identities and sexual politics. Even black gay men, I suggest, are guilty of transposing the historically specific implications of the black male orifice in slave context into contemporary registers of gender and homosexual understanding. As a solution to this tendency to erase historical specificity and to shine over the depth and rich metaphorical implications of the anus and oral cavity, I suggest that we read the black man in Morrison's neo-slavery novel as suffering from a condition of institutionalized hunger. The black men in Morrison's novel suffer under the same culture of hunger and human consumption that I have documented throughout this book. In Morrison's novel, this culture of hunger takes the form of stage breakfast scenarios, forced oral sex in the context of breakfast, and hungry niggers, who symbolize the compound experience of racial and sexual degradation. However, the difference between Morrison's hungering black male figures and, say, a Luke or a James L. Smith is that they bring us to a much clearer and immediate understanding of black male erotic hunger as an index of internal need, self-awareness, alternative gender expressions, and social roles, and longing for ancestral and ancient past. From this discussion of Morrison's novel, I segue into theorizing the black male interior space. My thinking along these lines is helped by Euston Baker Jr., who has written on this interior space as a tight spot, or tight place. The tight place, as Baker thinks of it, is a place of hunger and black male desire, a zone of homoerotic contact between black and white men, and a site of black masculine anxieties that date back to slavery. Though sexually suggestive, Baker's model does not formally ground this terrain within the male anus and oral cavities. Advancing upon Baker's claims, I ground this idea of the tight place in the homoerotic experiences of black men during slavery. In particular, I look at how anal and oral sexual contact between black men on the plantation served as a means of reconstituting African cultural legacies. Self and communal identity, the memory of and loss occasioned through the Middle Passage, and non-normative modes of gender expression. Rather than interpreting the anus and mouth as flat, utilitarian surfaces, I encourage and model a process of inhabitation, of theoretically embodying the black male interior. Only from the perspective of the inside, I attempt to show, can we ascertain the rich, fecund, and reproductive potentials of the black male orifice. The rape-hunger dialectic. At the end of the 20th century, the subject of slavery emerged in the hearts and imagination of Americans with haunting acuity. A cluster of novels about slavery, or neo-slave narratives, appeared at this time. Shirley Ann Williams, Dessa Rose, Gail Jones' Corridor, Charles Johnson's Middle Passage, Randall Keenan's A Visitation of Spirits, Octavia Butler's Kindred, and Wild Seed, and of course, Morrison's Beloved. In the visual arts, the work of Michael Ray Charles, Beverly McIver, Renee Cox, and Kara Walker all dealt with racial stereotypes, the historical memory of slavery, the recovery of slave memory, and issues of racial typing and demonizing originating in slavery. On a grander scale, films such as Sankofa, Amistad, and Jonathan Demme's Beloved brought the subject of slavery to the big screen and reintroduced the topic into the collective imagination. In this context of remembering and recovering the legacy of slavery, the notion of the black male erotic interior emerged as a recurring and haunting problem for black people. Black people expressed this concern over black male inner life through a range of cultural registers. These included Trudier's Harris' notion of nurturing male mammy figures, Alice Walker's depiction of male rape and coercion in a contemporary plantation in The Temple of My Father, of my familiar, rather, and Michelle Wallace's interlinking of black male rape with black grandmother's rape during slavery. The fear of rape at sea experienced by the black male protagonist in Charles Johnson's Middle Passage conveyed a general black male anxiety regarding issues of black male sexuality during slavery and on the plantation. Finally, as I have already described, there was, within black nationalist spheres, the equating of the male anal and oral cavities with racial dissolution and a death wish stemming back to slavery. These various considerations of black male inner life, though problematically fixated on male rape during slavery, signaled black people as, in a positive way, attempting to inhabit and more deeply embody the legacy of slavery. Morrison has suggested in an interview that the movement of black people away from the trauma of slavery has resulted in the abnegation of certain moral responsibilities. I think Afro-Americans in rushing away from slavery, which was important to do, it meant rushing out of bondage into freedom. Also rushing away from the slaves because it was painful to dwell there. And they may have abandoned some responsibilities in so doing. In other interviews and writings, Morrison has linked the legacy of slavery to contemporary U.S. fascism, the demonization of black single mothers, and the presence of black people as haunting specters in an early American literature. Slave experience, she insists, cannot be forgotten because it continues to have a real determining impact on the present. This legacy of memory is even more complicated and difficult to manage when it comes to the subject of black male sexuality, violation, and homoeroticism in the context of slavery. What we see from one end of the 20th century to the other is a pattern and geography of black migration that charts how black people have had to and have chosen to leave behind the issues of black male sex, sexual violation, and sexual ambiguity. Leaving behind, though, does not necessarily imply never returning to, especially when memory and trauma are experienced as cynical. According to the sociologist Ron Ironman, the memory of slavery has always reemerged in the collective black psyche in a cynical manner. Since emancipation, the memory of slavery has served as a container of important historical and contemporary events for black people. He writes, without the means to influence public memory, blacks were left to form and maintain their own collective memory, with slavery as an ever-shifting, reconstructed reference point. Regarding the transhistorical significance of slavery for differing generations of black people, Ironman clarifies, slavery has meant different things for different generations of black Americans, but it was always there as a reference. As I have pointed out, at the end of the 20th century, the meaning of the slave experience expanded to include homoeroticism and, more specifically, the topic of male sexual violation. I speak of rape and homoeroticism together, as a unit, because as Nero and others have pointed out, there has been, at least since the Reconstruction period, an unspoken correlation within the black imagination between all forms and expression of homoeroticism during slavery and the subject of black male rape. Over time, and across cycles of memory, the pain, trauma, and terrifying consideration of black male rape has overshadowed the distinct and complex ways that homoeroticism impacted and shaped the lives of black men during slavery. I dealt extensively with the topic of male rape in earlier chapters, but I come back to this theme again in this chapter as a way of more directly naming and more fully exploring the haunting specter that the topic of male rape has become. At this point, in the cycle of slave memory that Ironman delineates, rape operates as a phenomenon that overshadows the historical reality of the past. In terms of the black male interior, rape, though a real and disturbing historical occurrence, functions as a screen that keeps us from accessing black male emotional and erotic life in a complex way. Morrison's depiction of black male rape in Beloved is rare in the annals of slave history and neo-slave literature written about the slave's condition. Morrison's depiction of black men made to perform oral sex on white chain gang leaders contradicted these myths of black paternity and stimulated scholars at the end of the 20th century to reconsider the significance and meaning of black male rape under slavery. Before considering the import and various meanings these scholars have attributed to male rape, let me first describe and briefly analyze the rape scenario depicted in Beloved. The scene in question begins with black men awakened at dawn by the sound of buckshot, and then, one by one, let out of their cages and made to kneel before the white chain gang leaders. When all 46 were standing in a line in the trench, another rifle shot signaled the climb out and up to the ground above, where 1,000 feet of the best hand-forged chain gang in Georgia stretched. Each man bent and waited. Kneeling in the midst, they waited for the whim of a guard, or two, or three, or maybe all of them wanted it. Wanted it from one prisoner in particular, or none, or all. Breakfast? Want some breakfast, nigger? Yes, sir. Hungry, nigger? Yes, sir. Here you go. Occasionally, a kneeling man chose gunshot in his head as the price, maybe, of taking a bit of foreskin with him to Jesus. This scene, unlike any other in the novel, has occasioned among scholars a crisis in definition and meaning. According to E. Francis White, the black men in the chain gang experience homosexual rape at the hands of white chain gang leaders. White conflates contemporary homosexual practices and identities with the sexual treatment of black men during slavery. Noting her own ambivalence toward the topic of homosexuality under slavery, White offers the following explanation of why the topic is so disturbing and best classified as a homosexual act. Homosexuality has already had such bad press. Why add to that by pointing to instances in which it would have been seen as sordid and despicable? Admittedly, the acknowledgement of heterosexual rape during slavery does not make most people think that the entire institution and various practices of heterosexuality need to be condemned. But, of course, homosexuality and heterosexuality are not parallel and equal constructions. The latter depends on the former for its claim of normalcy. While White, quite appropriately, sees the privileging of heterosexual rape and heteronormativity under slavery as problematic, she adds to the problem by conflating the ideas and interior lives of the black and white men on the chain gang with the contemporary same-sex politics. Her commentary calls to mind Hazel Carby's very useful comments regarding the historical and political specificity of rape. Referring to the distinction between the institutionalized rape of black women on the plantation and rape used as an instrument of political terror alongside lynchings in the South, Carby clarifies, "Rape itself should not be regarded as a transhistorical mechanism of women's oppression, but as one that acquires specific political or economic meanings at different moments in history." In this case, White uses the notion of homosexual rape to bridge a contemporary understanding of homosexual subjectivity with the particulars of black men made to undergo oral rape under slavery. White conceives of rape as a transhistorical mechanism, and in the process flattens out the historical and cultural particulars of black men raped during slavery. She seems to ignore, for example, the implications of Morrison's choosing to depict oral rape over some other form of violation or penetration. Additionally, particular valences of power and self-glorification are invoked in the black man forced to kneel, take in semen, and verbally acquiesce to their abuse. White was not the only one to conflate past and present sexual politics in her treatment of Morrison's chain gang scenario. Nero, the black gay critic, refers to Morrison's treatment of the black man on the Sweet Home plantation as homophobic. In particular, Nero takes issues with Morrison's failure to imagine erotic sexual ties among black men on the plantation and within broader slave culture. Although deprived of sex with women, Sweet Home men were capable of enormous restraint, and for sexual relief they either masturbated or engaged in sex with farm animals. Morrison's depiction of the restrained Sweet Home men does not disservice, rather does a great disservice to the complexity of men's lives. Her description reinforces a false notion of a hierarchy of sexual practices in which masturbation is a substitution for intercourse. Morrison's description is homophobic because it reveals her inability to imagine homosexual relationships among heroic characters. By implication, sex with farm animals is preferable to homoerotic sex. Nero's complaint, more broadly, is that Morrison imagines homosexuality as the most degraded sexual option for black men on the plantation. While he does not directly mention the chain gang scene, this scene, which merges sexual violation and homoerotic desire, forms part of the homophobic tableau that Nero finds Morrison's imagination informed by. Nero's point concerning the failure of black people and black women in particular to imagine homoerotic ties among black men during slavery is well taken and reflective of larger historical dynamics that he documents. At best, he writes, our understanding of the sexuality of our slave ancestors is fragmentary. We need to uncover more and reread diaries, letters, and narratives to gain greater understanding of the sexuality of our forebears. At the very best, we need to revise our models of the black family and of homosexuality as alien to black culture. I fully agree with Nero's historical analysis and call for historical revision, but want to challenge the casual manner in which he, like White, draws correlations between contemporary homosexual politics and the particular and local circumstances of same-sex behavior practiced by black men under slavery. The emphasis upon sex and sex practice obscures, among other things, the ways that gender-variant behavior, and social roles played by black men on the plantation might have shaped their erotic lives. To see Morrison simply as homophobic is to overlook these epistemological and material considerations. In addition, the designation of homophobia obscures the long-standing historical problem that the topic of black male rape has represented to black people. Morrison's imaginative failure is part of a much larger network of imagining and remembering slavery that dates back to slavery and the first slave narratives written by black women. From Harriet Jacobs to Pauline Hopkins to Alice Walker and Morrison, black women have throughout history maintained an imaginative fixation upon the specter of black male violation. This fixation, as Nero asserts, has worked to obscure the deeper emotional and erotic realities of black men under slavery. Still, I do not believe that the solution is to completely abandon the topic of male rape for a more pristine, freer dimension of black male experience on the plantation. If anything, the consistent historical preoccupation with black male rape indicates the importance of beginning, as Carvey suggests, to unearth a deeper, more particularized understanding of black male sexualization, sexual violation, and interior response to sexual brutality. Derek Scott's treatment of the chain gang scene in Morrison's novel becomes closest to what I am suggesting in the way of unpacking and particularizing black male rape. After rehearsing the details of the scene, Scott moves to analyze the powerful reactions of African Americans to the scenario. what is at stake in the intense reactions to Beloved's chain gang episode, I think, reactions both convergent with and divergent from the homophobia and heterosexism of the dominant culture in the United States, is the very manliness of black man as a matter of fact in history. What is in jeopardy is African Americans' own investments in the truth of black manhood. Scott's observations call to mind Sojourner Truth's oft-repeated antebellum inquiry. Ain't I a woman? However, in this instance, the question becomes shrouded in historical silence, shame, and gender ambiguity. Ain't I a man? Ain't I a heroic and noble man? Thinking about this very personal statement in a broader, more historically sweeping context makes one wonder, at this late juncture of black arrival, if it is possible to recover any usable vestiges of manhood and honor from something as unspeakable and unpalatable as the breakfast. Scott refers to the oral ingestion of semen and the spectacle of black men made to watch, wretch, and perform as the breakfast. We are prepared to encounter anything and everything else in a scenario of this nature, he notes. But the notion of taking breakfast, the image and idea are too incendiary. What I would like to suggest, though, is that when we think about the breakfast in the broader context of consumption and institutionalized hunger under slavery, we see that the idea of meal taking represents only a small part of a much larger tableau of black male hunger and self-consumption. In the dialogue from the chain gang, the white man says, "Breakfast? Want some breakfast, nigger?" To which one of the black men responds, "Yes, sir." Again, the white man, "Hungry, nigger?" To which the black man again responds, "Yes, sir." Even more incendiary than the allusions to morning meal taking and the staple nourishment that breakfast provides is the black man's admission to hunger, his being made to hunger. Confronting a long-held historical silence, Morrison gives us finally, through the voice of a kneeling, helpless black man, admission to the reality of black men made to undergo institutionalized hunger during slavery. Only in brief, oblique moments have black men such as Frederick Douglass admitted to the reality of slavery, causing us to eat our own flesh, to slavery as a gnawing systemic hunger. But what Morrison does, mainly through the public staging of black male hunger, is hint at the range of interpretive implications of black male hunger, with hunger serving as metonymy for needing, wanting, being made to taste, lack, and the taboo desire to be filled.
Context of White Supremacy. That is the conclusion of the first audio segment. We will pick up, we'll be at the subheading. We're still in Chapter 6, The Hungry Nigger. We're picking up on subheading Theorizing the Black Male Orifice. That's where we'll pick up at. If you would like to participate, we are very close to the end of the book. I almost thought about seeing if we could stretch out and finish the book today, but it would take a little bit too much time. But we will definitely be done next Friday, final session. So be getting your concluding thoughts about the book, major takeaway points, questions. We will be all done next Friday. But this week, if you would like to share, the number 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. That number we'll give out again. If you are not able to use your phone or you don't want to use your phone to dial in, you can use the free VOPE line. It's linked at Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the address, it is tinytiny.cc/1race. And that is the number 1. tiny.cc/oneRace. So when you put in the address, look on the left side of the page, you'll see the link for the free VOPE line. When you click that, it will open a small window on your screen. First line, it is a drop-down menu. Select the number that I just gave out, which again is 641-715-3640. Next line, it will ask for the code. That code again is 564-943. Final line, it will ask for a name. You can put in a nickname, real name, you can type random keys, whatever you are comfortable with. Once you get all that information entered, click the green button at the bottom. It will connect you to the live program. You should be able to hear us. If you would like to participate, it is the same procedure. You'll see the dial pad on your screen. Press *6. When you do so, you'll hear an audio prompt. Press the number 1 and we will get you on the line. All of the folks who dialed in who have a hand up, feel free to chime in. Again, we are wrapping up. So if you want to be thinking of, you know, major takeaway points, what you think about the book, what we heard at the beginning to where we are now, if your thoughts changed, kind of be getting all that together as we get ready to wrap things up here. All the folks who dialed in who have a hand up, line should be open. Feel free to participate.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings. This is Rob in Milwaukee. Missed the live study session. I've been not feeling that well. I was listening, though, and I will say that the anti-sexual behavior is throwing me. So I'm just going to go right in. I know I won't be the only one that touched this disgusting topic, but the breakfast. And man, just the image of that, man, like, I try to guard my my brain computer on images, language, everything that, you know, I'm putting in. And this part of the counter racist grind is very hard to take. But the breakfast part, just the image of a black man kneeling before a white man to perform oral sex is disgusting. And I was sexually abused as a child by a 24-year-old woman. I was 13 years old, and she performed oral sex on me, and I haven't been the same since. And, you know, I haven't been the same to the point where I'm considering engaging in sexual activity with a despicable white person for that sexual act. And, something that's really standing out to me right now is that I dated a mulatto female, and from what I understand, this type of behavior is regular activity, I guess, in white culture, but for the white female to perform oral sex on the person in the morning. And man, I'm feeling some kind of way about that right now. You understand what I'm saying? Because it seems as though this consumption has a long, long history, and being caught in the turbulence of that is very hard to take. Gus, thank you for the program, and thank you for all the other participants on the line, and I will mute my line. Thank you for taking the call.
Thank you for sharing. I know it is certainly not easy. It is difficult to have to, that's not even, that's not even getting close to it, to say difficult, but man, the trauma that you have experienced with that, I know that is enormously challenging to cope with. Thank you for being courageous enough to share with us and just your feelings, experiences, how that related to the first portion of the text. Other folks that dialed in that we have not heard from, if you have a hand up, your line should be open. Feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. I'm kind of glad this we're getting close to the book. This is, it actually has been a difficult read. I agree with the first caller. I wasn't sexually abused, but that image of from Beloved is very disturbing, even to a guy like me. So I'm pretty disturbed by that. One thing that I wanted to point out is the part in the last chapter where he referenced Dr. King and talked about, I guess, some sexual deviance that was going on, you know, alleged sexual deviance with Dr. King, sleeping with, you know, black and white women and having sex parties and switching partners. And also interesting is when I was reading that, you know, it wasn't referencing anything. So I'm assuming that this is the author's thought of the whole, you know, of that. And that, you know, to me, I know some stuff came out with, you know, Dr. King, you know, having intermarital relationships, and they still haven't yet to prove that he did any of that. Now, I know Reverend Abernathy had said something about, you know, that he may have done something, but he never, what Reverend Abernathy said is he never slept with white women. So to me, that's kind of like, you know, the narrative that, you know, is going on in today's society with, you know, false news or whatever is going on, you know, trying to put information out there that's not true. So I'm kind of disappointed in that, you know, I don't know if, you know, whoever the editor is, you know, because I know the author, you know, passed away before the book was published, but was kind of disappointed in that information in regards to that. But, you know, like I said before, I'm actually glad that this book, because it's a hard read, and I was kind of disturbed by the scene, kind of disturbed by, you know, what he mentioned about Dr. King. So that's all I have right now. I'll mute my line.
I know. Other folks we have not heard from, if you have commentary, lines should be open. Feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you, Gus. Thanks to other callers and listeners. Greetings to you, Rob. I have to definitely concur with both Rob and the previous caller. I'm a person who's quite anesthetized to all kinds of violent and volatile things. That's just my life experience has taken me down a road where I can really watch violent things and it doesn't have the effect on me that it has on other people. And listening to this and using my imagination just due to reading the words, I totally concur. It's something else. To me, this is the most propagandist of the homosexual lifestyle as far as the sections of the book. I think this is just something that the whole LGBT community would eat up in regards to the types of things that he's saying and alluding to. He said something on page 202, actually. He said, when I first cited Harding's comments on cannibalism at the beginning of this chapter, I told only part of the story. The part of the story that concerned white appetites for consumption. However, it was not as simple as I initially suggested, that only white people wanted to consume, ingest, and be filled with black male essence. Black men wanted this too, however, for different and sacred reasons. Now, that is just, it doesn't compute, it doesn't make sense. There is no sacred reason for anybody to want to be homosexually filled. So it's just this propagation of homosexuality as a normal thing that is something that seems to, from his writing, you would think it's inherent in Black culture and not something that was infused and superimposed upon the culture by the people who dominated the people in question. Then he says, he says on the next page, he says, the most central problem here, though, is black male interiority, the Black male orifice. The Black female body is and always has served as a convenient, all too familiar tabula rasa for working out confusions, aggressions, instabilities, and a host of other masculine anxieties. If we replace the female body with that of the male, the essay's reference to chaos takes on new meaning. Chaos as the male Black male anus, chaos as the Black male mouth, chaos as the metaphysical, the quantum conundrum of Black male orifice that devours and consumes as easily as it might, easily might constitute and reify masculinity. In this section that follows in this discussion, Harding talks of the same Blackness as he associates the true blood and Black fathers as something that he, quote, in the darkness, unquote, touches and gropes with erotic longing. As we handle our Blackness, we attempt to fondle it, to worship it, to lie down in its beauty and sleep a long Black sleep of rapping and joy. The sentence that follows this one clarifies its referent to the phallic might of Black revolutionaries such as Brother Fanon and our fathers. Under the guise of revolution, of racial uplift, and racial unity, Harding's observations reveal a powerfully charged domain of Black male experience, wherein the consumption of and groping of the phallus, sons eating fathers and fathers eating sons, and a general erotic sharing among Black men is the norm. It is a painful, mythic, and social reality that Harding imagines in which hurt, quote, hurt is necessary, for it grows at once out of the nature of the struggle and out of the natural tendency of the sons, especially with westernized training, to seek to devour their fathers. Now, all of that stuff to me is almost like this. He's saying, or whoever edited this and wrote this, because I can't totally attribute it to the author, because he did pass away before it was released. But ultimately, it's like homosexualizing the entire Black revolutionary experience as one where the younger generation are seeking to consume the essence, including sexually, of the foreparents. So for me, being a student of Dr. Ben and Dr. Clark, I'm supposed to be devouring their essence and trying to, I guess, in my way, express their essence through myself. That is the most nonsensical, just the extremely homosexualized. It's like he's trying to homosexualize the entire Black revolutionary experience. And it's not in the proper context of the fact that he's also using the term homoeroticism. And I wish the titles would have said white homoeroticism, because the only people who are getting sexual gratification from raping Black males are white males, and it is rape. So he is actually homosexualizing rape and making it sound like it was. It's no different than when we talk about Black female slaves being raped by Black white male slave owners. It's the same thing. The only difference is they're replacing the Black female with a male. And he's basically turning this into a homosexual love fest, and calling it homoeroticism is really masking the fact that it's white people raping Black men and Black men having to be forced into a situation where they are being effeminized, and not under their own will, but under the duress of death and all kinds of things, in order to survive in a situation in which they're being effeminized and homosexualized wholesale. And this brings me to, I'll give someone else a chance to speak momentarily. This brings me to something Dr. Wilson talked about a while ago. She talked about when she was training as a psychiatrist that she started studying autism, because it was so rare. She had a young white male that she was tending to in the hospital, and that male got so much attention because autism was a rarity in the early 70s. And now, by the time she was speaking to us, it was epidemic. And she said that means something happened to cause this to become an epidemic, whether it's something in the food or whatever the case may be. The same thing happened now. 20 years ago, you did not see the sheer number of Black male homosexuals that you see today and Black female homosexuals that you see today. It was something that was rare. Now it is epidemic. So there is something happening that's causing this problem. Roundup is one of the main things that caused this. It causes the changes of male frogs to female, and it does the same thing to human beings. That's been documented. So thank you. I'll mute my line and give someone else a chance to speak. Hopefully I'll get a chance later, but that's all. Thank you. Wow.
Yes, Rabir?
Yes, sir.
Okay, greetings, Gus. Greetings to callers, Ross, and all the rest. I'll start with page 181, where the author started to reference the now Dr. Vincent Harding as drawing a connection between the consumption of Turner and the contemporary consumption of black men. And Harding, thinking about black male consumptions, reflected traditional models of black male fertility, literacy, and enlightened consciousness. The counterpoint to that, to the virile, powerful figure in Harding's essay, is not, and most of what the other black authors of the 10 black writers' response feel that the counterpoint would be effeminate, homosexual, and therefore emancipated black males. So later on in the book, we see he goes back to Harding and he's quoting from his book, Going Into Beyond Chaos, Black History and the Search for the New Land, where Harding makes reference to this black man in The Invisible Man, Ralph Ellison's novel, True Blood, that rapes his daughter while he's in his sleep. But he's talking to Dr. Norton, who is the president of this historical black college. And I guess something happens while he's describing the incident. You know, they sort of unite or whatever in a erotic tryst. But when Mr. Norman exclaims in wonder, "You have looked upon chaos and are not destroyed." And I think that that's probably the namesake of the book, Beyond Chaos. But to me, you know, him talking about this interiority part, the inner workings, I guess, of the black male masculinity. If you look at saying that True Blood projects his feelings of emasculation, sexual violation, and economic disempowerment upon the black female body. And then I think he goes on to kind of reduce that into the male office, and then therefore chaos from that.
Mr. Demery, your sound dropped. I don't know. Like, I don't. Are you on a headset or a mic piece or something? Because your sound, you were really clear, and then like 10 seconds ago, your sound kind of got distorted.
Okay, can I be heard now?
Much better, crystal clear.
Okay, all right. Well, I'll quickly go to Augusta Deal on page 212. He was a mentor of Dr. William E.B. Du Bois, and this particular guy, I think he was the manager of the Crisis newspaper, too, the newspaper that Dr. Du Bois edited. Well, he was discovered in one of the subway bathrooms molesting another man. So Dr. Du Bois had to fire the guy. But then if you look at the footnote in footnote 11 in the back of the book, it shows that Dr. Du Bois had some reservations about firing him. I guess what the author is trying to show is that the hypocrisy of the way some of these well-known, iconic black people believed was contrary to an idea, I guess, of inclusion because of their sexual preference. So he talked about Eldridge Cleaver also, you know, in his book, Soul on Ice, that he talked about faggots, and he he was kind of down on the gay lifestyle. And then he met James Baldwin at a party and engaged in a passionate kiss, you know, with James Baldwin. And whether or not any of this stuff is true or not, you have to think about there was no libel suit filed or whatever. And Huey P. Newton, you know, wrote this. But the thing is, he's trying to bring up a point on the hypocrisy of, I guess, this black male masculinity. And in a system of white supremacy, I don't think that black male masculinity exists, because the system is either consuming you or emasculating you. And then, I guess last but not least, the part with Toni Morrison's chain gang rape, the breakfast episode where I guess the guards gave the black men a choice to perform oral sex on them or to be killed. I don't, you know, see how, you know, something like that, you know, can be brought into black sexuality or anything to do with homoeroticism. Well, maybe on the white men's part, it just shows the savagery and the what white domination is really all about, when you can, you know, do something of this nature and just go to the extremes, like the lady said in the beginning of the broadcast, you know, just the extent that you go through with the power you have over another individual. I'll mute my line and give somebody else a chance. Thanks for taking the call.
Much obliged, Mr. Demery Four. If other folks have commentary, please do not wait till the last few minutes before we get to the second audio clip. If you have anything that you would like to add, some of the notes that I took, I too thought that this section that we read this week seemed to be the most political in terms of advocating gay rights and LGBT issues that lifestyle. It seemed to be most stringently promoted in this section. Specific things that I noted, the portion, this is, I guess, kind of the top of 203. This is still in the Nat Turner chapter. What black feminists and so-called homophile figures such as Baldwin were painfully aware of was how this dynamic of the chosen black son excluded women and homosexual men as representative voices of black experience. I reject that, and this is something that we've talked about kind of in the same notion of this idea of black male privilege. We have had a number of feminist scholars on the program and asked, evidence. Do you see evidence after the conclusion of plantation era, white supremacy, slavery? Do you see black males going about establishing something that people might call patriarchy, where black males' experience or lives are valued and they have abilities and power that no other black people have, black females or, quote, black gay males or anybody else? And folks have not been able to step forward and provide evidence. They've said consistently, no, that is not the case. That's not saying that, you know, things have been perfect. How could they be in the system of racism, white supremacy? But no, you do not see that. We talked about that before with Yurugu as well. Dr. Marimba Ani, her text that if you look before racism, white supremacy, that valuing black females in a complementary fashion, to reference Dr. Baridi's work, that is a staple of what we were doing before the invaders. So I just categorically reject that portion. I know some people disagree. That's fine, but, you know, whatever. Moving forward. Same page. The more central problem here, though, is a black male interiority, the black male orifice. The black female body is always and has always served as a convenient, all too familiar tabula rasa for working out confusions, aggressions, instabilities, and a host of other masculine anxieties. Just, in my view, seemed like a bit more of the black male bashing. Seemed like there was a lot of that this week. Continuing in the same vein, folks have a different opinion. Speak up, please. Next, this is on 205. His critique of Vincent Harding's writing, he was included, Mr. Harding was included last week. Interestingly, Mr. Harding passed away the same year this book was published, 2014. He referenced Mr. Harding's work last week. He was a part of the contingent of black writers, including John Henry Clark, who responded to William Styron's work. It seems my perception was that Mr. Woodard and the editors, whoever was involved with this book, that they were very critical of how the black writers responded to Styron's admittedly fraudulent work on Turner. So he continues with his critique of Vincent Harding this week, saying homoeroticism was intrinsic to black cultural formation in his formulations. And he's talking about consuming Nat Turner, that literally that was what Harding wrote, that black people are empowered by consuming his words, Nat Turner, in his legacy, and the way that he talked about Malcolm X. He's talking about in Harding's There Is a River, the Black Struggle for Freedom, which is widely cited. In fact, if you go back on Democracy Now!, they talked about this very book when Vincent Harding passed in 2014. I'll post it on the Facebook page if you want to go back and check it out. But he talks about the way that he speaks of Minister Malcolm and Dr. King as the black shining princess, and he says Harding romanticizes the seductive virility of blackness and its hidden phallic implications. So too does he romanticize female rape, incest, and white male fascination with women raped on the plantation. There's no footnote, so this is all on the author and or editors. I have not read There Is a River. I would have to read it myself and come to my own conclusion to see if that is an accurate interpretation of Harding. In the next segment, he continues kind of with this same theme of black males being homophobic or patriarchal or just valuing their black male experience over everyone else with Eldridge Cleaver. I think I cited last week because he did the same thing with Eldridge Cleaver. I think his view on homosexual activity. And I said that I did not think it was representative. I did not think it was accurate to make Eldridge Cleaver representative of black males. I think many, many black people would say they did not agree, do not agree with his views, what he had to say in Soul on Ice. That was where he quoted some of this material from, at least from last week, with regards to Eldridge Cleaver. I think a number of black people, the majority of black people, maybe even, would say that, you know, Cleaver does not speak for me. And, you know, it is not correct to say that his views are representative of general black thought. The folks who were saying they were surprised or did not think it was correct, the commentary on Dr. King, I guess I was not as surprised. This book was published in 2014, and it's in so many other books that I've read. I think one of the callers that mentioned Reverend Abernathy, who was one of King's contemporaries, associates, he wrote about it in his book. Michael Eric Dyson wrote about it in his book that came out in the early 2000s, I May Not Get There With You, which is a biography exclusively dealing with King. And he talks about it in detail and says a lot of the exact same things. Sex with white women, even in that text, he even hints at he's sourcing Wiretap. It's been a while since I've read it, but if I recall, he is sourcing as though he's been able to read some of the FBI footage from their surveillance, right? That he's either been able to read some of the transcripts, because some of it, if I recall correctly, it's as though this has been quoted. I would have to go back to double check to see if that's accurate, but it's in that book. It's widespread. I think it's correct for anyone to have suspicion about this, that this could be a total lie, a major act of racism, master deceivers. That could be the case. Even if it's true, he is a victim of racism, white supremacy. So, you know, I think in my view, at least, most of what I have seen is to bring this up to either say that he was a despicable person and we should not have any regard for him. I've seen that. Or to say that, you know, we should put his face on, you know, the gay rights flag because he was with us, that sort of thing, which, in my view, both of those views serve the system of white supremacy. Next, he says, just feel like there was some heavy handed bashing of black people as we kind of go down the stretch here, where he says, as mightily as black people have struggled to fend off the reality of Nat Turner's consumption, pause, I reject that. I am a black person, so I've been told. I did not reject the consumption of Nat Turner. I didn't know about it. In my view, racists deliberately have hidden, suppressed this information, which I think was a point he made in the book, that increasingly this is the sort of thing that just is not discussed. White people are most to blame for that. They decide what gets published. And white women specifically have a big role, a disproportionate role in deciding who gets published, who doesn't. But that is another program. White people are responsible for keeping me uninformed about Nat Turner being cannibalized. And then he continues. He says, and in the meantime, our analytic, historical, psychic, and political tools, talking about black people, I presume, have been insufficient to the task of analyzing how this consumption was possible, how it might, in fact, be ongoing, and how we, again, I think he's talking about black people. Yeah, because he says it's black people. So black people in the present moment are implicated in the legacy of Turner's consumption. Again, I totally reject that. I am not implicated at all because I didn't know. Now that I know, I'm talking about it, and I will share this with other people. But I am a victim. If anyone, the people that are most to blame are white. They are the ones who did the consuming, killing, enslaving of Nat Turner to begin with. And then they are the ones most to blame for this being hushed up. Apparently, there was a point he talked about it in the book when it was widespread in Southampton, Virginia, where black people said, don't, you know, consume the castor oil because they cannibalized and put Nat Turner in there. Don't do that. So apparently at one point, black people were not participating in this conspiracy. At some point, I guess that information wasn't shared or got lost or whatever it is. White people maybe got more aggressive about saying hush up about all that, but the information wasn't being passed on. White people are most to blame for that. Continuing. Yeah, the escalating, we're going, getting into chapter six now, The Hungry Nigger, where he says black gay men began to bravely articulate and embody a suppressed history and politics of the black male orifice. It just seemed to get really, really aggressive. They should have just, you know, put the rainbow flag up on all the pages as it goes down the home stretch, which I think, if I recall correctly, it kind of mapped that out, that this was going to happen in the introduction. I remember thinking about some of these ideas back in the introduction, and then, you know, it kind of was focused on what I wanted to talk about for most of the book, and then this was going to kind of be there at the end of the book. So it shouldn't have been a total surprise for people who recall the beginning of the text. Let's see, continuing. I thought it was massively incorrect. This section, this is on 210, kind of middle portion of 210, where he says, in the confessions of Nat Turner recorded by Thomas R. Gray, a white man, Nat Turner too experiences the Holy Ghost as a mediating and corporealized presence, like experiencing it in the body, experiencing the Holy Ghost in the body in a physical form. And from the first steps of righteousness until the last was I made perfect and the Holy Ghost was with me. Hemphill experiences the Holy Ghost as anal penetration and a resultant sacred bloodshed. I find this really, like, massively incorrect. And in my view, this is why I talk about those metaphors where people make comparisons. They compare two things that are not equivalent. If you're going to a text, a 19th century text, talking about Nat Turner and him saying, allegedly from this white man, that he was having a spiritual experience that he could feel. And that he saw drops of blood on the corn, and talking about all this as he's going to be executed, and to compare that to some anal experience, fictionalized, literal, figurative, whatever the case, that is massively incorrect in my view. I totally reject that. That's why I say you really got to be mindful when people make those types of comparisons, just to see if it makes sense to you. Maybe the person that's presenting it, it makes sense to them, might not necessarily be logical to you. And if it's not, you should stop, ask for questions, and really interrogate. Think on it some more, because they might be trying to put something on you that's not logical. Let's see. Next up, his critique of Mary Baraka. He was Leroy Jones earlier, like 1960s. Mr. Baraka was also married to a white woman. I think that's mighty significant. His critiques of him, where he says, Mary Baraka's homophobia and formulation of a negative anal sexual politics perhaps Wright Simmons, it is the homosexual desires Baraka had as an adolescent and young adult that motivate his homophobia. Simmons traces Baraka's malice and violent disposition toward the faggot to the author's vexed experiences with anal sex. Baraka admits these experiences to a hooker named Peaches after failed attempts to achieve erection. And then he goes on to all these ways where, you know, he's messed up his mind, is screwy, blah, blah, blah. I checked the footnote, and this is from Ron Simmons' work. This is not from, like, Baraka's autobiography. Maybe I need to go read Simmons to see where he's getting this information from that Baraka allegedly divulged. I'll take it, at least for the moment. Let's say that this is true. Question rage, but let's take it that this is true, that he said this. There was no evidence presented of the violent, he says, his violent disposition towards the faggot. I'm taking that to mean individuals who classify as homosexual or same gender loving, whatever term you use. I have no evidence. I'm not aware of him being violent, like him attacking someone, if they mean physically. Now, if they mean some other way, maybe if they mean he was violent because he referred to these individuals as being, quote unquote, faggots, if that's what they mean, I'd like that, you know, explained. But I'm not aware of him being violent against individuals because they're classified as gay, what have you. Kind of seems to me similar with this pattern. I almost feel like there has been greater critique, attack of black people and black males specifically than racists, white people. I feel like last week he did a lot of justifying and excusing for William Styron's racist fraudulent conduct. I have not felt the same sympathy with regard to black people and their treatment of homosexual issues. I'll get in one more comment and then I will stop and see if folks have any other commentary they would like to add. I was cracking up laughing. Make that two comments. I was cracking up laughing when I got to the 2:11, still chapter 6, where he says the anus and anal copulation, on the other hand, represent the erosion of black male prowess and sexual vigor and the breakdown of racial solidarity. Simmons also traces these negative implications of the anus and of black gay identity to the ideologies and political praxis of other Afrocentric thinkers and leaders, such as Haki Madhubuti. He wrote, Obsolete. He's talking about black males. I read the book. I just forgot the title because it's kind of long. But great work. Black male author Louis Farrakhan, Ben Yakinen, and Malefi Asante. I was thinking when they do like the 2014 10-year edition special publication, Gus T. Renegade will be added on the list of no good homophobic black Negroes. And, you know, he had the legendary Negro scholar Cleo Monago on his program and he didn't listen to Brother Cleo, and no good homophobe Gus just continued with his homophobic rhetoric for years on his no good brother. Look for that in the 2024 edition of The Delectable Negro. Yeah, I will stop there. I did have the other thing that I said I was going to get in. I did not have the same. I totally understand. I'm just sharing. I did not have the same response to the scene, the rape scene in Toni Morrison, where the black males were forced or were raped by these white guards. Same thing is happening right now. You can insert Daniel Holtzclaw. The same thing is happening right now. And because I've heard this so many times. This is in the book Texas Tough. Graham Reynolds, we had him on the program. This is a white male. His book came out in 2010, and we had him on the program. He's talking about the history of the Texas prison system and how it has a massive influence on the prison system throughout the country. But one of the scenes in the book, he describes almost the exact same thing, except it's an anal rape with this prison guard. And I remember the scene specifically. We talked about it on the program with the author, where the guard anally raped the black prisoner in front of the other black inmates. And then after he was done, he pulled out his penis and asked if any of them wanted to sniff the bat. That's in Texas Tough, 2010. It's in the archives, June 2010, where that. And then this pops up again in Douglas Blackman's book, who also was a guest on the program. It was turned into a documentary that came on PBS not that long ago. It's just Slavery by Another Name, Douglas Blackman. He also is a white man, but he also has same scene. It's rife. If you do enough reading, you'll see this over and over and over. Maybe I have been anesthetized to this sort of savage and perverse conduct, because there is so much of it. If you read the literature, you'll really will be able to see some of the patterns of white sadism. And I'll stop there. Any folks that we missed have commentary that they would like to share? Anybody that we've not heard from at all have commentary? Emma, did you have commentary? You should be with us as well. Playing with her mute button, I suspect.
Actually, I was. Can I be heard? Greetings, folks.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. It also brought to mind the youth prison in, I think it's Mississippi, I'm forgetting the name of it, where the whole town pretty much like came up because they put this prison in it, in that area. And all of the prison guards, I mean, well, I guess I can't say all, but a majority of them were engaging in abhorrent behavior with the youth. And these were, it was a youth jail, and they were raping the little boys. I just agree with everybody else, because I felt the same way, that it's propaganda. This is a part where I feel like the editors really, I mean, I don't know, I can't say, I wish he was still here, so maybe we could talk with him a little bit and get his perspective, but I'm going to err on the side of white people having had a lot to do with this section, because I noticed the inconsistencies as well, and it just seemed like a totally different person wrote it. Like, it just was, it was just deviant from a lot of the other, the tone of the text. I mean, it could still be him, but I feel like white people had a lot to do with that. I will say that I don't, from what I'm gathering, I really could see him having a struggle with his sexuality and this book being how he's trying to figure that out. However, I feel that the book would be more relevant, more potent, if we spent more time making conclusions that were logical in the book, because the conclusions that are being derived are, to me, they're non-logical. Like, they don't actually make sense. If you have a people who've been subjected to so much sexual abuse and they start exhibiting sexually deviant or non-sexual behavior, and then to say, well, that's part of the culture, so now we should embrace those people, that's not logic. Logic says if the people have been sexually abused and they're exhibiting sexually deviant behavior, then the people need remediation or to work through that, because the behavior is a symptom of the abuse, not let's embrace the behavior without doing something to heal the abuse. And so I feel like if we could get there someplace in the text, somewhere, it would be great. But so far, I haven't seen that. It just seems that it's too linear in the sense that it's like, well, people were abused. Now they're exhibiting. We've had these thinkers. Now look at us. Here we are. This is what we're doing. It's part of our culture. And I have to reject that kind of thinking. To me, that's very European, very Western, very white, to think like that. Instead of saying, you know, we can we'll fix it. Yeah, I'll say that. We can fix it. We can heal it. We can make it better. People can stop doing things that aren't even making them happy. So even though they try to say that they're gay and gay means happy, that's one of those ways of controlling people's mind with words and stuff like that. But I disagree with that as well. I don't think that my experience and observations have said that people who are engaging in non-sexual behavior are not actually that happy doing it. Also, I feel that I have to agree with one thing. I think that because we've been so abused and so victimized by the system of racism, white supremacy, and white people, and sexually, even to the day, that people who have had, who are engaging that behavior or had that experience, don't need to be shunned. I think like I don't think that produces justice, and I don't think that that moves us closer. I think that that's evidence that we can have these conversations in a healing way and accept what's been done to us and say, well, this is what we need to do to fix the problem. So I agree, because he said that. And I mean, to me, that makes sense. That's logical. We can't go and be like, you over there who've been so abused and are all sexually confused, we're not going to listen to you. You have nothing to say. That's not true. Those people do have something to say, but not, hey, let's all just be gay. Like, no, that's not the conversation. But if you want to share stories and observations and things like that. So, yeah, I do agree with that. I was disgusted, really, because it almost makes it seem like, who are you writing for? Who was this section for? To me, it just seemed like a piece of sexual literature. From what I, for the majority of what I heard, did not seem at all to put this into context or to make it, to make me feel, man, that's terrible. It was like this, like a sex, like a porn, like literature and porn, or porn and literature form. And I was like, wow, I mean, we're supposed to be talking about how we're being consumed, black men are being consumed and homoeroticized. And it really seems like this is why I think white people wrote this part right here. And they just like forgot that this was in the context for black people or something like that. And it just seemed like any of the other narratives that white people would have been consuming in some type of like sexual way, that like it doesn't cause the individual, the person, to really understand that this is rape. Which I feel like anytime we're talking about sexual violence, sexual abuse, rape, like it should sound, it should come across that that's what we're talking about. But you're being subversive. We've observed that in the text. It's subversive. So no, and I don't appreciate, this is just a personal thing, the putting these leaders in here to say, well, they're engaging in some kind of sexually deviant behavior. What is the point of the book? This part made me really, okay, what is the point of the book? Are we supposed to be talking about how black men have been consumed and homoeroticized by the system of slavery, the system of racism, and white people in general, or what? And so I'm already on the, this is just, I think white people really messed this up, because one sentence can really change a lot. And so I think white people got their hands on this. There was some other part, but I'm, for some reason, forgetting it. It just, yeah, if I can remember it, I'll chime in on the second part. Thank you all for listening.
Right. I definitely agree. It was much more, it seemed pornographic, just the semen of like entertainment or just enjoying the explicitness of the sexual violation of these black people, both real and even the fictions, because the fictions are very much based in truth. They were talking about like Beloved is fiction, but very much based in truth. Let me see if other folks have anything else they want to get in. We still have about 10 minutes before we get to the next audio segment. If not, that's fine. We can start it early. I'm just looking to make sure I didn't have anything that I missed. The portion about... You can go ahead. Feel free, Roz.
Thank you. I appreciate it. First, I wanted to say I was listening to another radio show yesterday, and they discussed that LGBT History Month is going to be the month of February. So this is how they're trying to correlate black history, black people, with the history of homosexuality. That's mind-blowing, but not really mind-blowing in the system of white supremacy. On page 206, the author wrote, what Harding understood as sacred consumption was partially that, but it was also part of something larger, more complicated, and disturbing. Douglas, for example, was painfully aware of those aspects of the slave experience that were causing us to eat our own flesh. In his slave narrative, Douglas referred to the legacy of violence and terror that caused many slaves to remain frozen in terror and apathetic to their bonded status. He referred to the constant haunting presence of grim death, a catch-all term, for the range of horrid deaths that resulted from desperation, nihilism, and soul murder. Douglas understood self-consumption as a process of turning in upon the self, a natural response to the physical and spiritual starvation endemic to the culture of slavery. That paragraph was so important because, to me, the most important part is when he says Douglas understood self-consumption as a process of turning in upon the self, and it was a natural response to spiritual and physical and spiritual starvation endemic to the culture of slavery. To me, that's what homosexuality mirrors in the black community. It is literally us turning in upon ourselves, and it's not to denigrate anyone who is homosexual. You know, I don't judge people for what they do in their bedroom, but I totally agree with everything that Emma said. I thought her presentation was brilliant. And to me, that's a process of turning in upon the self. You're not propagating life. So as a result, you are turning in upon yourself. And Emmy was saying, it's something that we need to work towards healing, because it is not natural and it is not something that propagates life. And once you understand that, and when you study black history and the fact that all of this homosexual behavior became a part of our sexual expression upon contact with white people and Arab people in particular, who bought those behaviors and raped both men and women wholesale. Thank you. And I'll mute my line.
For sure.
Wait, can I be heard really quick? I remembered.
You're being shunned.
That's not funny, guys. Okay. Thank you, Raj. You made me remember that was the last and final point, that I feel like this book will become the cornerstone or a part of the cornerstone that replaces how we define oppression, and that oppression will no longer be race-based. It will be, and is now, we're looking at it, gender, or the LGBTQQA/queer/women's whole thing. And because now, like, when you say, if you even try to say that you are oppressed or victimized because you're Black, you cannot do that. It is now only, you either have to be a female or be some kind of like part of that LGBTQQA, whatever group of people, to even have a valid argument that you are experiencing discrimination or oppression. And I thank you, because I was thinking about that even in the psychology class. There's rarely any talk about racism. Only talk about this whole thing here. And there was a part in the book, I can't remember exactly where, but that's the feeling that I got, that now Black, it's not because we're Black, it's all this other stuff. And so it does not surprise me that their month will be February, because there will come a time, and if it's not already here, you're not, like, Black people are not oppressed at all, and actually never really have been, as a matter of fact. Like, that's going to be the new conversation. Okay, that was it. Thank you.
Return to shunning. I thought.
Yeah.
Oh, Mr. Demifor?
Yes, I wanted to get in one last comment. When he was talking about essence, Tim Hill, starting on page 209. But actually on 210, when he was saying, through the sacred idea and the sacred relationship of his anus, Hemhill built upon a legacy of Black people using their bodies and body parts since slavery to reconfigure the precincts of the sacred and humane. And the use of the body parts, you know, it went on to say, for example, Sojourner Truth, at strategic moments in her oratorial career, referred to her breasts and her womb in public speeches. This reference to her body parts had a dual effect. First, it allowed her to make claims to the spiritual and maternal authority of women from the Bible, and second, it facilitated her challenge to the stereotype of the masculinized Black woman. And I want to speak upon that. If we look at patterns of the system of white supremacy, one of the patterns is to masculinize Black women. Recently, an Olympian caster, Semenya, was subjected to that masculinization. I think they had her to disrobe or show her genitals or whatever to prove that she was a female. So the same patterns that was going on hundreds of years ago is still going on today, and you just have to look to see that system never changes. It stays true to their strategies. I'll mute my line.
Right on. Let's see. I had a few other quick things, and then we'll get to the second audio segment. The portion about W.E.B. Du Bois and checking the footnotes, great, where he lets go Augustus Dills, is a black male who's arrested for having sex in a tea room in the 1920s. Anything that a black person is forced to do, required to do in the system of racism, white supremacy, white people are most to blame. Let's not act like black people are in charge of what W.E.B. Du Bois is doing, what any black person is doing, this person having a job or not. We are all responding to white people. That was one. And he even mentioned that twice, where Dr. King, he said the same thing about Bayard Rustin, where Dr. King had to distance himself from Rustin. And I hear that all the time. Man, there were tons of black people who were shunned or denied a job or whatever, resources, because, oh, well, I think this person is a communist, or I think that, you know, this person, whatever, is stepping out on such and so, or I think this person is a spy, or just whatever, for any reason or no reason at all. That happens all day long in the system of racism, white supremacy. There's tons of illustrations like that. We had the same conversation with Cleo Monago, where he said, you know, black people are homophobic, which was a theme in this chapter, I would submit. Black people are homophobic because they name call gay black people. Well, black people name call all kinds of black people. I mean, you know, stand in line, join the club. That happens, you know, regardless. And, you know, he just would not, you know, concede on that. And that's just, you know, a point where we differ. If we're just going to pick out, you know, these little small things where black people do all kinds of incorrect behaviors to a variety of black people, but that's not, you know, that should be, we can accept that as being true without losing fact of the main problem that is causing all of the chaos and injustice is white people, racist man, racist woman, racist child. I also thought he had a few portions where, I mean, the metaphor is talking about the anus as a site of, you know, sacredness and discovering something, I mean, and fertility and productivity. It just seemed way out of control. It did not seem logical. It just seemed like, I think Mr. Fuller has talked about how racist they want to promote confusion, where we victims of racism don't even know what to do with our genitals. They can get us to a point where, hey, I don't even know my anus is for eliminating waste from my body, period. This is not, you know, whatever else, a site of sacredness and, you know, communing with eliminating waste from my body. That's it. Like, total confusion about our bodies, the world, what to do. That's what they want. We can get them in that point. Great. We do not have to worry about them replacing white supremacy with justice. Anything else I want to make sure I get to? I thought he even contradicted himself here at one section. He says that there is a fixation of black people on black male rape. In fact, I want to make sure that I read it exactly as he says it here. Let's see. Yeah, because he says that there is like a fixation on black male rape. But I thought that one of the main points that he'd made throughout the text was that this is an aspect that is discussed or left out regularly in terms of black male rape on the plantation. I'm going to make sure I can find it. If I can't find the next second or so, I'll just share it in the next audio segment. Yeah, I thought even some of the whole critique of Toni Morrison, this segment that he reads here, where she gets critiqued by this author Nero for, I don't know if this is a black person or not, I suspect it could be. She gets critiqued for not, I guess, having a scene in Beloved of black male homoeroticism where they're in some sort of arrangement together. I mean, where are our priorities? In my view, that is not improvement. That is not heading towards justice. That is not moving us anywhere closer to where we need to be. And I certainly in 2017 could easily see Quentin Tarantino or somebody saying, you're absolutely right. Let's make sure we get that film made in time for next February. Two birds and one stone, Gay History Month and Black History Month. Anybody else have anything they needed to get in before we get to the next audio segment? I assume folks are satisfied. If you had something that you did not get to share, make sure you write it down to get it in during the next audio segment. This segment is kind of short, and the book is almost done, so this will be a little bit short, and then next week we will have a short segment overall, and we'll conclude the book. So we're still in Chapter 6, The Hungry Nigger. Chapter 6, there's a brief cameo from Gus T. reading a couple pages right at the end, but not too much, so you hopefully will be able to tolerate. Context of White Supremacy, Vincent Woodard, The Delectable Negro.
Theorizing the Black Male Orphis. We can better apprehend the erotic implications of black male hunger if we begin by considering some of the history and genealogy of the mouth in black experience. The mouth represents a sacrosanct structure of black cultural production that black people have, for the most part, conceived of as an outside of the domain of sexual violation under slavery. For the black male spokesperson, orator, autobiographer, and speech giver in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, the mouth has symbolized, more than anything, the entrance and exit port of freedom and self-definition. Slave narratives, itinerant speeches, pamphlets, abolitionist treatises, letters, reportage, poetry, and historical fiction published in the 19th century all serve as examples of how the foundations of black antebellum experience were laid in speech and literacy. In light of this historical trend, it is understandable that a resistance to thinking about the black male's mouth as sexual receptacle would exist in scholarship on the black slave experience. In Turning South Again, Rethinking Modernism, rereading Booker T. Houston, A. Baker Jr. provides a useful model for beginning to think about black male orifices as emblems for and receptacles of black cultural production. Working through the metaphor of tight spots or tight spaces, Baker defines these zones of black male experience that have both geographic and erogenous connotations. Jim Trueblood from Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man and Booker T. Washington serve as illustrative examples of these tight spaces, which are sexually, erotically charged spaces, spaces that antebellum and Reconstruction black men had to negotiate as they moved out of home communities and into the world. For Trueblood, the father of a sharecropping family in a southern town, the vagina of his daughter is the tight spot that he finds himself in one night as he lies beside her in bed. The tight spot represents a number of economic and historic factors that make life for Trueblood, a poor southern man, difficult in the post-antebellum era. Trueblood experiences himself as limited and tightly contained as a result of having to labor for a white landowner whose family once owned his ancestors as slaves. Also constraining are impossible seasonal crop deadlines, an inherited impoverished social status, and the fact that he has no capital and therefore limited social agency. All of these factors come into play on a night in which Trueblood accidentally rapes his daughter, whose vagina represents, in the context of his social constriction, the impossible task of having to move without moving. A number of black feminist scholars have taken issue with this idea of the tight space, critiquing both black men and women for using this structure to glorify and reify the phallus and to label black women's sexuality as a sign of so many unspeakable, vacuous zones within African American experience. And Dixiel bring a helpful gendered interpretation to bear upon Ellison's Invisible Man and Baker's glorification of the black male phallus in the novel. Speaking in terms of male and female texts, masculinist and feminist readings, Dixiel offers, it may be that the heart of this controversy lie not only different notions of truth, art, and history, but very different readings of the phallus and the penis. counterbalancing Baker's reading of the tight space with depictions of father-daughter sex in Morrison's The Bluest Eye. Ducille continues, what for Baker is an aristocratic procreativity turned inward is in Morrison's novel a bolt of desire that ran down Charlie Breedlove's genitals, giving it length. What Baker calls outgoing phallic energy, Morrison names inbreeding lust, a lust bordered by politeness that makes a father want to fuck his daughter, tenderly. Lucille's analysis exposes the phallus as the natural corollary to the female tight space. The phallus and the vacuous vagina are the symbolic representations of a long-standing history of black male and female sexual violence. Both Ellison and Morrison rework an antebellum and reconstruction dynamic of the castrated black man and the raped black woman. Baker adorns and dresses up this history by imbuing the phallus with cosmic potency and positioning the phallus as the organizing, ruling principle of the entire clan or tribe of Afro-America. Morrison and other black women before her, such as Zora Neale Hurston, Jessie Fawcett, and Nella Larson, critique this perspective of the phallus in their writings. But one thing that none of these women does, including Ducille, is reconfigure the symbolic framework, a phallus in relationship to vagina, in a way that accounts for the male body also having erogenous orifices, tight interior regions, that have a life and symbolic significance apart from the male-female dyad of sexual violation. Drawing on an example from Booker T. Washington's life, Baker extends his thinking on the tight male place into the realm of oral performance and erotic oral fixations in black men. For Washington, the erotic historical implications of the tight space coalesce around the prospect of giving a speech. This is not just any speech. It is his famous 1895 address to the Cotton States and International Exposition in Atlanta. Washington makes history with this speech. He is the first black man in the South to publicly address an influential crowd of Southern and Northern property owners, heads of state, and business persons. Washington experiences terror and an anxiety because he knows that the Northern and Southern whites present are looking to him to represent the Negro race and to assuage their own anxieties and fear about the Negro's emancipated place in larger society. It is a white farmer who observes and expresses to Washington. Washington, you have spoken before the Northern white people, the Negroes in the South, but in Atlanta tomorrow, you will have before you the Northern white, the Southern whites, and the Negroes all together. I'm afraid you have got into a tight place. This example from Washington's life provides an example of speaking, vocal execution combined with enlightened reason, characterizing black masculinity in this post-emancipation era. We can say also that for Washington, as a former slave, this instance of speaking is further articulation of his emancipated status and that of all the impoverished black Southerners whom he represents through his speech. Should he say things politically offensive to Southern conservatives, or offend his Northern, more liberal constituency, he could very easily experience social castration, in the form of being cut off economically from donors, evicted from the land on which Tuskegee Institute sits, and literally lynched and castrated by the same types of whites who ran Ida B. Wells out of town for reporting on the horrors of lynching. Summing up the implications of tight spaces, Baker describes them as constituted by the necessity to articulate from a position that combines specters of abjection, multiple subjects and signifiers. True Blood's narrative is produced for a rich Northern white philanthropist. Representational obligations of race in America, to speak Negro, and patent sex and gender implications, the role of the law as the phallus. Baker describes Washington and True Blood as struggling to come into their own phallic agency in the context of institutional and white male phallic power. He establishes a clear relationship among phalluses, but does not go far enough in locating in the male body itself the tight erogenous regions that he theorizes. Trueblood's sexual penetration of his daughter is an externalization of his own tight, highly sexualized predicament. In addition, it is an externalization of the ways he feels violated and is made to reproduce plantation and postbellum sharecropping economics. Trueblood experiences a type of economic and social penetration at the hands of a number of white men, the plantation owner, the owner of the sharecropping fields, and the northern white philanthropist who takes a titillating interest in Trueblood's rape of his daughter. Trueblood's violation is unspeakable in the gendered economy of slavery and reconstruction that Baker works with, and so, within this limited context, Baker gestures towards a recurring scenario of male sexual violation but offers no incisive analysis of black male orifices as spatial, transhistoric, and especially sexual sites of identity formation.
Cautiously gesturing toward the sexual in his discussion of Washington, Baker does note that there existed a deeply homoerotic bond between Washington and all white men, but in particular and most expressly between the Wizard of Tuskegee and General Armstrong. He says little more on this topic. His comments, though, lead me to wonder how Washington's homoeroticization of militarized authority overlaps with the implied erotics of his speech. Thinking along the lines of the tight place, I wonder about Washington's mouth, his vocal acumen, as the instrument through which he orally handles and grapples with the violent, coercive, erotic interests of phallic law. So much of African American scholarship is premised on ideas such as the talking book and the recurring tropes of acquired literacy and oral competency in the making of black masculine identity. In the context of the Atlantic slave trade, Equiano experiences reading the Bible and developing a relationship with Christian deity as implicitly erotic endeavors that serve to reinforce phallic law. We need to begin to account more fully for books and literacy as a means of reinforcing sexual silence at the same time that they enable speech. We also need to account for the particular ways that whites have eroticized the black male mouth, even in the context of acquiring the habits of civilization. Homoeroticism and sexual knowing, for example, strongly inform the male slave voice and body in the slave narrative genre. The narratives of Frederick Douglass, Solomon Northup, Austin Stewart, and Moses Roper, among others, are rife with examples of gender variance, sexualized violence, incestuous master-slave dynamics, and exposed genitals, buttocks, and backs. In the context of these men's lives, speaking, the mouth, and textual presentation take on an overlapping erotic significance that has been little noted by scholars of slavery and the slave narrative genre. Baker's idea of the tight place is important and potentially very useful, as it names a concept and mode of thinking about black male sex that black men and women have employed for the past 150 years. In 1970, Vincent Harding wrote a landmark historical essay in which he referred to black history as emptiness, the void, and the chasm. He, too, used Ellison's Trueblood scene to characterize the chaos of black history as female and sexually castrating. In other writings, though, Harding makes clear that projections onto black female anatomy and sex disguise a deeper, more problematic figure, and that is the black man who hungers, who has the capacity to ingest and interiorize. Harding alludes to himself and to blacks more broadly, fearing that they will be devoured by inverted sexuality. Harding's expressed fears illuminate the importance of theorizing and positively embodying notions of black male hunger and erotic appetite. Already, we have developed a corpus of beliefs, cosmology, spatial mapping, and racial self-fashioning based in the intangible yet active presence of the hungering black male. Already, the hungering nigger serves as an index of homoerotic and racialized experience, suggesting that our theorizing of race, black male inner life, and homoeroticism need to occur within a closer, more syncretized framework. To counter this spatial logic of the tight place as emptiness, void, chasm, and vacuum, we might begin to think in a more concrete manner about the correlation between actual geospatial places and the interior space of the eroticized male mouth and anus. We already have precedents for this way of thinking. With the example of Washington, we have the erogenous oral region coinciding with Reconstruction era claims to tilled and harvested land, to postbellum sites of slavery, and to a sense of southern homeland sought after by emancipated slaves. In the 1960s and 70s, we have the eroticized black male anus made to signify black urban and inner city dislocation, the landscape of plantations and black men sexually violated under slavery, and the home space of community defiled by the presence and desires of black homosexual men. In the late 20th century, the black male orifice still signifies, to many, absence and a culturally threatening vacuity. What I am suggesting, though, in opposition to this logic, is that we begin to think about male erogenous regions as constitutive of place, belonging, and presence. I am suggesting that we find in the anus and the oral cavity productive and reproductive relationships to land, landscape, place, home, and homeland, among other sites. Such a shift in perspective would take us a long way toward realizing the positive implications of the tight place as inhabited, inhabitable, and a culturally productive space.
Context of White Supremacy, cameo, Gus T. Renegade. Even narrating that portion was not fun. If you would like to participate, and that's what we'll pick up at next Friday, that'll be the last section, the black male sodomite. That's what we'll pick up at next Friday. But if you have commentary you would like to share, the number again, 641-715-3640, code 56493 pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Any thoughts on why, now that we've almost read the full book and people that have heard Dr. Tommy Curry, his views on the program before, why do we think Dr. Curry has such an affinity for this text? Like, he's the one who first mentioned it, and he's mentioned it more than once on this program. I played some of the sound clips where he talked about it over the years. Now that we've almost read the whole thing, what do we think Dr. Curry likes or takes in a constructive way from this text? That's maybe one folks can comment on as we go. Everybody who has a hand up, your line should be open. If you have commentary you would like to share, feel free.
Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, I just wanted to comment. I believe that Dr. Curry
wanted us to read this book because there's a plethora of black authors and intellectual thinkers, people that, you know, we probably need to be familiar with. I looked up Julia Hare. She was mentioned earlier, and I didn't know about her, but she was a dynamic person. And, you know, some of the authors and the poets, regardless of their sexual preferences, they were brilliant individuals. And I think it's noteworthy that we should probably know them and be familiar with some of their works. But back to the text, I think that the play on words with the tight spaces, you know, was a reference to probably the anus and oral fixations that the author is referring to in the book. And I'll just use True Blood as an example. You know, when he raped his daughter and his wife was trying to kill him, and she was pregnant by him, and his daughter was pregnant also, you could say he was in the proverbial tight space. And then for him to work his way out of it, and then the whole idea about, you know, the tight space, I guess it's a, you know, like an acronym. But I'll mute my line on that. Thanks for taking the call, Gus.
Other folks, appreciate that, Mr. Demery. For other folks that would like to comment, your line should be open. Feel free.
Greetings, everyone. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
My answer to why Dr. Curry wanted us to read this book is I don't know. I've heard him on your program many times, but I guess I missed the part about this book. My comments, I kind of like have been just listening to the readings, and what it appeared to me is when we first got started on the book, there was some constructive information that was being discoursed to us, and then it started a turn towards I would say strange at best, as far as that concerned. What the author, non-white or white person? That's a question.
Black male.
Mm-hmm. Did the author at any time reveal his sexual reality?
I think the author passed away in 2008, but I think a lot of folks have stated that there's information online that suggests he is might have identified as being quote unquote homosexual.
Okay, because one thing that I the way my brain computer figures in the. What is sex? The eighth or ninth area of activity?
Eighth?
The eighth area of activity is if white people, and I suspect they have something to do with this in some sort of way, they are going to have sex very close to any efforts on our part to counter racism because of its potential power and influence, and their ability to deceive and or confuse non-white people. They've been highly successful on it. And although, you know, if a non-white person, non-white black person, whereas, you know, it computes where things start taking a confusing turn, you just utilize, you know, VGQ. A white person is somewhere in mixed up with this, based on what I've been hearing the last couple of Fridays. And I mean, it sounds just like it to a standpoint. And I've actually seen some similar dialogue that comes from non-white black people who politicize sexual confusion. Now, they may talk about racism, white supremacy, and I would give them the benefit of the doubt that they are serious about it, but nevertheless, their sexual understanding rivals a lot more than I would be comfortable with, rivals a lot with the attempts that we should be dedicating ourselves to counter the system of racism, white supremacy. And I've just been thinking about this while listening to it. And also another there's two more things that I got to include, is that these examples of real life people, and this is common with white people also, to mention about, to imply that so-and-so is contradictory because he would condemn anti-sexual behavior, but yet he would kiss, tongue kiss, which is a sexual maneuver, another male, and every last one of those people that I heard in the last reading talk, they're all the deceased. Therefore, they do not have the opportunity to speak on their behalf. And that is something common that white people love to do. Not saying that necessarily physically it was a white person directly involved, but it that's one of their tactics. And I'm picking up on all of these things, and those are just some of my observations, you know, with the reading. Maybe I'm probably a week ahead, because I know at the end of the reading, you know, that's really the time when people give their comments, their final comments on the book. But those are my thoughts in my head right now, and I probably will forget it if I don't say it now as opposed to next week. Thank you for listening.
For sure. Retired firefighter. Any other folks that have a hand up, have commentary they want to get in?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I guess, yeah, I agree with the firefighter. Brilliant commentary. Also, weirdly enough, when Mr. Demery brought up the story of True Blood, it actually made me think of a true story from my life when I was 14, which was actually the year that I lost my virginity. I had a girlfriend who was actually being sexually molested by her mother's boyfriend, and her mother actually blamed her and then actually attacked her, and she ended up going into foster care. And that was something that had a serious effect on me. So it just made that memory come to mind, just thinking about some of the horrific things that we've learned from white people to do to one another. To get to the text, I agree too with Mr. Demery and also with Emmy too, that all of this homosexual propagation and propaganda, it definitely seems like it's coming from the mind of a white person. So I would chalk it up to that as well, because I'm pretty sure there's white people involved. If it's a text that's dealing with racism, white supremacy, and white people cannibalizing non-white people, there's going to be white people doing things here. And this just reads like it. And I think Emmy was brilliant for bringing out the fact that the text does not even read the same. It seems like there's two different people writing the book. I agree with her on that. Also, on page 222, the author writes, "Do seals
analysis exposes the phallus as the natural corollary to the female tight place. The phallus and the vacuous vagina are the symbolic representations of a longstanding history of Black male and female sexual violence. Both Ellison and Morrison rework an antebellum and reconstruction dynamic of the castrated Black man and the raped Black woman. Baker adorns and dresses up this history by imbuing the phallus with cosmic potency and positioning the phallus as the organizing ruling principle of the entire clan or tribe of Afro-America. Morrison and other Black women before her, such as Zora Neale Hurston, Jessie Fawcett, and Nella Larson, critique this perspective of the phallus in their writings. But one thing that none of these women does, including Jaceel, is reconfigure the symbolic framework of phallus in relation to the relationship to vagina in a way that accounts for the male body also having erogenous orifices, tight interior regions that have a life and symbolic erogenous orifices, tight interior regions that have a life and symbolic significance apart from the male/female dyad of sexual violation. And I just, again, this is just like a wild propagation of anti-sexuality that, again, just leads me to think that a white person put that there. And what I find also is a subject of the way white people sexualize Black people is they tend to focus on the degradation of Black sexuality when it comes to heterosexual activity and the propagation and praising of anti-sexual behavior. So it's almost like psychological warfare, and that's how I read that section, as a propagation of anti-sexuality and a degradation of the Black male heterosexual experience and the coding of it in some sort of violent exchange. So I find that to be a serious part of white psychopathology. And on the following page, 224, he writes something, says, cautiously gesturing toward the sexual in his discussion of Washington, Baker does note that there existed a deeply homoerotic bond, homoerotic bond between Washington and all white men. And I found that to be very telling because I think I said this last week that I've never met a white male that was not either homosexual or homoerotic. I've never seen any such thing as a masculine white male ever. I don't care if they're big with muscles. They all either practice homosexuality or some sort of homoerotic. They have a genetic attraction to that sort of stuff. And but when he alluded to all white men, I took that as the fact that all white men could have and possibly would have under the right circumstances taken sexual advantage of him and gotten away with it because they were white. And also the fact that I just believe that white men look at us that way. Like when we're having everyday experiences and we're walking down the street and you might, just cross eyes with a white person in passing, that they look at us that way all the time. And I just think we don't notice it because we're just so used to being around the enemy so much that we don't take these things seriously. But I believe that they homosexualize us everywhere they see us. That's just my opinion. I could be wrong, but I really don't think so. Thank you very much, and I'll mute my line.
Your volume is a little low.
How about now?
That's better.
I have to agree with the everywhere we go being, I would say, if not homosexualized, sexualized, like hypersexualized. I feel that way. Like every time I'm being looked at by a white person, there's something sexually nasty going on in their mind. Why did Dr. Curry encourage us to read this book? I haven't listened to all of your conversations with him. I maybe listened to one or two, but I think because he read it, and I think because he read it and he was able to get some useful information out of it, he thinks that we would too, and we have. I think there are certain stories or historical like recounts and things like that that may be present in this book that might not be present in other books that may talk about something similar. So it's just good to have information. I think depending, it might, and this part would be me, that being able to look at the confusion, I don't know how he would, I can't speak for that, but I think one thing I'm walking away with is there's a lot of confusion in the text. a lot of sexual confusion and then just like a lot of identity confusion. I think I've heard him talk about identity politics and stuff like that. That might be part of the reason why as well. It'd be great to ask him. Right? So now that we've read the book, really, what were we supposed to get from it? But maybe something to do with identity politics and getting some information out of it, some useful constructive information, because there has been some. One thing that I'm really interested in with the text is I thought this book was supposed to be isolated in homoeroticism and slavery. And I just realized how much time we've been spending talking about all these folks who came after that, which I think if that's the case, then you got to talk about everything else. You can't just pick and choose. You can't cherry pick what you want to. Well, I guess you can if you write the book, but what is going to be useful for your aim? Mission, whether this is him or the editors, because I feel like if we're going to talk about the way the book went in the beginning, there should be at least be mention, or some more mention of lynching and all of that went on with that, and then dissecting that a little bit more. And then I also noticed that there seems to be, like, if we were going to talk about, if he was going to talk about this, say that this is something, then it wouldn't be momentary instances where someone French kissed another person. I think you would be recounting actual so-called relationships and all of that kind of stuff. But instead, it's just abuse and then moments where people do something non-sexual. So I don't really know what to make of that other than it's just to push the agenda, the mission of the book, which I think is just to historicize and normalize non-sexual behavior for Black men specifically, and to put it into some sort of historical context so we can say, well, when another person wants to write a book on it, they can cite this book and say, well, see, this book says it, and so therefore, when enough books say it, then it's going to be true. That's how it kind of works. But I think that, yeah, it's hard to really say because I feel like he's just really confused, searching for himself and really trying to figure it out. And then the white people got a hold of it and like did something else with it. But yeah, that's pretty much what I'm walking away with. I do think that there should have been a lot more, because I feel like there's a lot more information out there, and him being having been an academic or a so-called intellectual would have had access to that information to include in the text, which would have really fleshed this whole thing out about how Black men have been homosexualized. So that's what I thought the book was about. And then to say, here's what we can do. But yeah, thank you.
Anybody else who had commentary that we have not heard from?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I missed most of the second audio. I had to run out and get some medication before the pharmacy closed. But I wanted to chime in on the last audio segment on the first female commentary, Emmy, or I think her name is. But when she pointed out, like, what is the book really about? And man, it just kind of seemed like a commercial for homosexuality, and it's really romanticizing the terrorism that Black males experience at the hands of the race soldiers, and it seems like that's the, you know, the overall theme of the book. And something that I wanted to touch on that I did miss in the last audio segment was the part about Eldridge Cleaver kissing James Baldwin, and the way that sounded, it sounded like almost glorified, along the same way like how Dr. King was portrayed, like. And I'm getting the impression, like, from the author, like, and I could be in error, and I hope I am, but it's like, yeah, I'm gay,
but look at what these other black people doing too. And I don't know if that's coming from the white people that had the final say over the book, but it has been a very difficult read. And man, I really wait till Friday to pick the text up. And what is very, I would say, spiritual for me at this moment, I have never read Ralph Ellison's The Invisible Man, but I'm actually reading it right now. And I had just actually read that part about True Blood and Mr. Norton and the college. And, man, it's yeah, that text is amazing. And thanks for taking the call. I'll meet my line.
Mm-hmm. That is in my top five, Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man. We have talked about that book. We talked about it with Dr. Martin Kevorkian, admitted white supremacist. He was on the program in 2009, and he uses Invisible Man as like the intro to his book and as a theme he returns through as he explains racism in literature. And then we talked about it, really pretty black female. I'm just blanking on her name for the moment, but she's like gorgeous. She's at the University of Iowa, and she's written about Ralph Ellison repeatedly, about both him as a person, things he did in his life, and then interpreting Invisible Man. But that I was going to say that last time. From that book, I think it's interesting, since this is brought up the scene with True Blood, where he rapes his daughter and gets her pregnant, even. This tight space, and this is used as an illustration of black males just using black females to vent their frustrations or for whatever their triumphs, their meager triumphs under the system of white supremacy, maybe the one of the few ways they can demonstrate their manhood. What happens, or how you hear about all of this, is past tense. This has already happened. In the book, when we meet True Blood in Invisible Man, the daughter is pregnant, and they're explaining how all this came to be. And this is the main character of the book, is chauffeuring Mr. Norton, who is a powerful white man, like the white people that Carter G. Woodson has to answer to get funding, the Wizard of Tuskegee. Powerful white man who's at a historically black college. That's where the main author is at this point in the book. He's taking him around. He's been trying to keep Mr. Norton away from True Blood. Like, oh God, this crazy nigga is gonna, you know, get me in trouble with this white man, and I get thrown out of school, and let's get away. And the white man insists, like, you know, I want to talk to this True Blood guy. Who is this fella? You know, let's talk to him. And so he hears this whole story about how he raped his daughter and blah blah blah, and the white guy gets, you know, ill or what have you. But the interesting thing that did not get included is that True Blood comes up, and he says that after I raped my daughter and the white people found out about this, all of my financial problems disappeared. Everything became great for me once white people found out that I had raped my daughter. And you can interpret from that what you want. In my view, it's almost as if once I confirmed this is how white people like to project and think of black people, monsters and monstrosities. I raped my daughter. White people love it. That's great. Let's keep him around. Yes, this is the image that we want to project of black people. So no problem. You don't have any bills. You don't have to worry about anything. We'll make sure that you are cool for as long as you live. So we could point to, yes, that is the niggers of the town, True Blood, raping his own daughter. That's what niggers do. But yes, he comes up after white people find out. I also think it's a significant comparison to what happens at the university. That's in Invisible Man, where the black main character, who I believe is Dr. Bledsoe, he has to accommodate Mr. Norton. Might even be an example right there, what he's talking about, of a homoerotic relationship. Mr. Norton, the racist, is he taking advantage of Mr. Bledsoe at the university? Folks that are reading, I think we have quite a few folks who are reading that book. Next time I reread it, I'll have to think about it. As with the section where he talks about Carter G. Woodson, not Carter G. Woodson, I'm sorry, Booker T. Washington, mixed up the names, Booker T. Washington. The section where he talks about Booker T. Washington and, you know, him having a homoerotic relationship with all white men, and it might just be something as simple as maybe this could be stated better. I think Roz said when we were talking about the first audio segment, if the title said white homoeroticism if it was stated in such a way to reflect the sexual deviance of whites, where they are demanding that Booker T. Washington, in order to get funding, in order to for Tuskegee to thrive, he has to accommodate their homosexual desires, whatever that means, saying what we want you to say, speaking about racism the way we want you to do it, or not speaking about racism at all if we don't want you to do that, or any other favors that that might encompass. That, in my view, would be more accurate than kind of just, in my view, the way it was written and the way it was depicted. And I felt that many times throughout the text. You all can check me if I'm incorrect, but it's as the sexual deviance is being transferred to the black person. And even it's not deviance. It's just the part of their gender fluidity or, you know, their own interest or appetite for homoerotic conduct, homoerotic stimulation. Continuing, let's see some of the, I found the passage that I meant to quote in the first portion of the text. It was right in front of my face and I just missed it. So, it says, let's see. I missed it again. Every time I have it right in front of me and then I end up moving off of the, okay. If anything, the consistent historical preoccupation with black male rape indicates the importance of beginning, as Carby suggests, to unearth a deeper, more particularized understanding of black male sexualization, sexual violation, and interior response to sexual brutality. This is on 219, bottom of 219. I thought, this is what I mean about sometimes there even seem to be some contradictions within the text. I thought he'd said consistently that there has been a consistent suppression of black male rape, that this is something that does not get talked about, that you do not see this in different slave narratives, that this is something that, you know, generally is not discussed. I thought he said both black male rape during slavery, and I think he even said last week that many black people were not even able to hear this. They weren't even able to accept this, much less be preoccupied with it. And the same thing with white women sexually exploiting black females on the plantation. But if I'm in error, you know, folks can set me straight again. The portion later on where he says, this is on 226, top of 226, where he says, the home space of community defiled by the presence and desires of black homosexual men. I, just in my knowledge, and I could be in error, but in the United States, I am not aware of that being a widespread sentiment among black people, that the quote-unquote community has been defiled by the desires of black homosexual men. I do not think that that is a widespread phenomenon amongst black people in the U.S. over the last 100 years, 20 years, 10 years. I do not think that's the case. I'm sure there are folks that'll point to, as they already gave some names, Louis Farrakhan and Haki Madhubuti and other folks, maybe Gus T. Renegade, maybe. I don't know. Maybe it's a longer list of folks that they would put on that list, but I don't think that that is widespread. I think the bulk of black people have way other problems that they are concerned about or what have you, if they even consider quote-unquote homosexual activity a problem to begin with. I do not think that that is the case. And I've heard that consistently from people like the great Cleo Monaco on the program, where somehow this becomes like the greatest scourge of the universe, black homophobia and what black homosexual people are having to deal with. And I think that that gets grossly overstated on a regular basis to the benefit of racist man, racist woman, racist child. I will stop there. Did folks have anything else they wanted to get in before we conclude?
Yes. I didn't get to answer the question about Dr. Curry. And I think, in my opinion, one of the reasons I agree with Mr. Demery for, and I agree with Emmy as well, but I think another reason that he would have wanted us to read the text is because of the accuracy in the documentation, especially in the first half of the text regarding the historical documentation, because that is such a little spoken of subject. I think that this book is one, if not the only text on the subject where it's all compiled focusing on the rape of black men. If I remember some of your discussions with him accurately, I think there was like almost no books on that subject. So I think just with that Even though you have to suffer through the rest of the whole propagation of homosexuality and all of that nonsense towards the end, I think just to have that sort of historically accurate documentation at arm's length to be able to quote and document that sort of stuff, it's just priceless to have. So that's my opinion, because when I was talking about it last summer and saying that's a book we need to read, it was for the same reason. I was just like, wow, this stuff is incredible to read as far as just the documentation, and to have something where you can readily reach to it and say, look, pay so-and-so, and this is what it says, and it's actually something that happened. So that's what my opinion is. Thank you very much, and I'll meet my line.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
To answer the question, I think that he would want us to read the text to highlight the rape of the black male and the consumption of the black male, because until reading this text, I wasn't aware that Frederick Douglass was sexually terrorized. And along with, I didn't know Langston Hughes was quote-unquote anti-sexual. So I have gained constructive information from the text. And I want to kind of address like the homophobia thing, because the subject came up in one of my college courses before I withdrew. And I was just honest, like, I don't feel comfortable around people that claim themselves gay. I think it's the flamboyancy of, like, you know, them being that way. I had older cousins that was gay in my family, and I never felt, like, comfortable around them. They just made me uncomfortable. And I guess as I'm older, trying to explore, like, why I'm uncomfortable. Like, it's a gay dude that lives next door to me. And I speak to his mom, but I cannot speak to him. I don't even look at him. And as I'm examining my feelings about it, I feel that people that are quote-unquote gay, I feel like they just completely gave up. But with that being said, and this is going to be graphic, but it is reality, it is said that people can reach climax through that act. And the guy said on the book Sentenced to Science, remember you had him on the program, Gus, and he specifically said, like, man, you know, dudes would be in there talking about, man, you know, well, we ain't bring nothing up out of him that wasn't already in there. And he totally discredited that and said, man, he's seen people, you know, get totally broke down. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Well, context of white supremacy. I can answer my own question with regards to Dr. Curry. I think he would recommend this book. We can ask him when he comes back, but I think it's it reminds me of many of the times when we've had white people on the program where they've written a book, where I've said a good number of these white people, they might have constructive information in the book, but I suspect they're still practicing racism. So you kind of have to pick out the constructive from act of racism here, this is not accurate, oh, another act of racism. You kind of have to pick out all of that. You have to pick out the constructiveness. I felt that, you know, with this book, but there was a lot of constructive information. I would say pretty much all of the information about the cannibalism, and even we talked before about starving enslaved black people on the plantation, that itself being an act of cannibalism. I think Emmy and Raj, you all described that earlier weeks, maybe even a month ago, that portion where he talked about white women raping and sexually exploiting black females, and how that does not get discussed at all, how a lot of this starts at childhood. I think there's a lot. The whole cannibalism thing, I hadn't, you know, seen that anywhere. The section, I've quoted it continuously. I shared it today with a different listener about the, I can read the sentence exactly where he says, the plantation was a spiritual and emotional wasteland. Such women hungered and even starved for the affection and attentions of their husband. Talking about white women, they learned to harden and deaden themselves to physical and psychological abuses. And furthermore, in the context of such brutalities, developed a method of nurturing and sustaining themselves by drawing upon the erotic and psychic energy of black women. Brilliant passage that I just hadn't thought of, but I think that is a huge aspect of how white people practice racism, white women and white men, draining the spiritual and psychic energy of black males and black females. I think that happens all the time. That's right there. That's a passage I'm going to use moving forward. It's a lot of great information, a lot of detailed other books that he references. I got books just from going through this, so there is a lot of constructive info to take, just, you know. System of Racism, White Supremacy.
What page was that? I'm sorry for cutting it. What page was that?
159.
Oh, okay. Thank you so much. Brilliant.
Top of 159.
Brilliant. You focused in on a really nice chunk right there. That was amazing. Thank you so much. But you exude brilliance throughout this whole discussion this evening. I appreciate you and everyone else who chimed in as well. Thank you.
Yeah, it's a lot of good stuff to take. I definitely... I cannot say I'm disgruntled about having read the book. It has been quite a read. And we will wrap up next week. Criticisms aside, it has also had a great bit of constructive information. Anything else folks need to get in? Nice. We will be here tomorrow. Compensatory call in 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. We will review the last 7 days on the plantation. One of our listeners, they posted on the Facebook page today. There was video of a courtroom scene where a black female was brought to court where she did not have any pants on, literally no pants. And they had not given her any feminine hygiene products while she was and she was just in jail. Right. She had not been convicted yet. They were still, you know, adjudicating everything. And it was a white female judge, and she suspected race soldier, but she, you know, did rightfully flip out. Like, what is going on here? What kind of, you know, barbarism are you all practicing where you can't even get somebody a pair of pants? I mean, a towel, anything. Like, what is going on? And she demanded somebody, you know, come down and be held accountable immediately, which showed, again, white people have the power. They can solve a lot of these problems, like, right now. But the person who posted this said it reminded them exactly of Delectable Negro and just the variety of ways that white people are consuming us and sexually violating black people all the time. And I guess I will end with the folks who were talking about how difficult this was. I guess for me, putting it in perspective, watching what happened to Khalif Browder, that was very difficult to see, since they're kind of at the midway point of his documentary. They've shown the first three sections of it. That, even right there, I might say that might be another form of black consumption. I talked about it with Emmett Till, where once a black person dies, we don't, you know, a live living black person that could be helped, you know, we could actually solve some of their problems, improve their quality of life. Oh, get out of here, nigga. You know, probably rapist, drug addict, all of the above, looter. That damn Obama. But a dead black person, oh man, we can heap all sorts of attention. You know, we can take 5 years and tell a documentary about your life and what you did and what you went to in school, all of that. I've seen this for years now. This is like the new genre, is consumption, necrophilia. I've written about this, consuming black death. Now everybody can, you know all about Khalif Browder. Yes, I think it's important for people to know about who he is, but man, it is very depressing seeing how the system of racism, white supremacy consumed him in life and now continues that consumption in death. It is quality viewing, but I'd still say that might be another example of Delectable Negro. That's it. Compensatory call in tomorrow. Global Sunday Talk on Sunday. And again, that is early 3 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Central, 12 noon Pacific. This Sunday should have listeners tuning in from various spots around the globe. tune in if you have the time. You can ask questions. Black people will definitely ask them about the whole kerfuffle with Samuel L. Jackson's comments on British actors. We normally have a good number of black Brits joining in the discussion. If you have questions or if you want to email your final comments in about the book for next Friday, feel free to do so untiljustice@gmail.com. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. The next book, I was very committed to doing The Man in the High Castle, but a new biography just came out on Coretta Scott King, and it's written by a black female, a renowned black journalist, and I kind of would like to do that. I'm going to look at it. I have it. I'm going to look at it over the next week or so if the audiobook exists for it, because Gus T. is not narrating. But if the audiobook exists for the new documentary on Coretta Scott King, and I think Miss King actually worked with the biographer for a number of years. So this is kind of as told to. So if there is an audiobook and it's unabridged, that's what we'll do next. If that does not exist, then we'll do The Man in the High Castle. I guess if we had, yeah, I could probably get somebody the book. If we had any females who'd be down to read Coretta Scott King's book, I don't know how long it is. I don't think it's massive. I guess we could do that. We've done that before. If this is all just if the audiobook doesn't exist, I'll check. If it does exist, moot point, we'll move forward. I'll let folks know by tomorrow evening. Drop an email if you have questions, guest suggestions, commentary that you want to share on the book for next week or anything else, untiljustice@gmail.com. UntilJustice@gmail.com. Weekend, I will state again, and particularly this weekend, since it is a so-called holiday, I hope no one is out getting green beers and acting goofy with whites, race soldiers. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. I don't think us having a beer or a cigar, cigarette, anything else is going to help us remain safe from race soldiers, the likes of Daniel Holdsclaw, Darren Wilson. If anything, the record has shown, even think about what they mentioned with Eric Garner every time, cigarettes. Put all of that down, I think that would allow us to protect our health, our brain computer, and maybe allow us to think a little bit better so we can crank out some solutions to the problem, racist man, racist woman, racist child, white people. That's it, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.